You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next,
Guns and Butter.
This is Guns and Butter.
Something happening, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
What it is ain't exactly clear. There's a man with a gun over there.
We have 9/11. In which the hammer comes down and beats you over the head for the rest of your life with a big national security stick. And so that people learn to duck their head and not speak up. Because, bad idea now. You know, we now have, I think, 20% of the American population is 15 or younger. I think that's the number. These are people who grew up. They don't know anything other than post-9/11 America. And actually, let's say that anyone who's under 25 really doesn't. I mean, they were kids. So that's probably, what, a third or more of the population. It's all going away. The whole past of the United States, the whole idea of rule by the people, of privacy. We have an entire new generation. They're growing up without any of that. It's all gone.
I'm Bonnie Faulkner. Today on Guns and Butter, Richard Dolan. Today's show, Understanding False Flag Operations in Our Time. Richard Dolan is an author and historian. He is nearing completion of a groundbreaking book, A History of False Flag Operations, which will explain one of the most pernicious developments of our time, how clandestine agencies secretly engage in violence and destruction in order to promote their agendas. He has published 4 books and numerous articles on anomalous phenomena, suppressed science, secret space programs, breakaway civilizations, the intelligence community, and similar subjects. He is best known as the author of 2 volumes of history, UFOs and the National Security State. He studied U.S. Cold War strategy, Soviet history, and international diplomacy. Today's presentation, Understanding False Flag Operations in Our Time, is from the Architects of the New Paradigm Conference in San Rafael, California, January 16, 2016. Richard Dolan.
In addition to writing books, I've spent many, many years doing private consulting work. Basically, I'm an independent writer, and I would meet with individuals one-on-one, thousands and thousands of them. And it was a great experience for me just to sit down and talk with someone about their life, about their career, about their anxieties and everything else. And what I've always noticed is that when you start scratching the surface of someone's worldview, you find very quickly that they, just as you, have an understanding that there's something not right with the world around us. And not everyone has the motivation or the education or the background to kind of dive into this like a madman obsessed with getting to the truth. But they know, they feel it in their bones, there's something wrong, desperately wrong with the state of the world. And it involves a feeling that they're not in control anymore. In particular, I think we can see this in the last 20 years in the United States, where we've had severe economic dislocation. I live in the northeastern part of the United States, and I've gotten to see really the obliteration of a company that informed the town that I live in. That's Eastman Kodak in Rochester, New York. And I just watched Kodak go poof over the past decade and a half. But I think you can see this story everywhere, in many places of the U.S. And it accompanies a kind of loss of hope, a loss of confidence, a feeling like the future really is going to be worth something. In addition to that, those people who try to learn about their world by turning on the television and watching CNN, you know, inevitably what they find is that they're totally confused about what is happening. It just seems like one damn thing after another, one terrorist thing doing this and one national security thing doing that, and these crazy people, why do they hate us? And there's really no sense of understanding when you kind of plug into the establishment news media. And it doesn't seem to be like, how do we solve any of this? How do we fix this? How do we really get to a better world? Why can't these people just like freedom and democracy like we do? I mean, this is the kind of nonsense that, and so there doesn't seem to be a way out of it. And I would say that all of that confusion, all of that hopelessness is by design. I believe this now. I don't believe, as I might have years past, that, you know, the people on top, they're trying to do their best, but it's a tough world out there. No, no, no. They want you to feel helpless. They want you to be confused. And let's talk about why. One reason why is that the whole planet is being stolen. All right? So you got this many people who want to own every single thing that's worth owning in this planet. All the water, all the genetically modified foods they want to shove down your throat, all the minerals in the ground, they want every single thing. And they're getting it. They got it, actually, and they just want more. That's the way it's happening. All right? It's a transnational corporate financial theft of everything. It's a war. And when there's a war, the people who are running that war really don't want you to be able to react to it. They don't want you to be cognizant of what is happening. And they want you to be quiet about it. They want you to obey and be compliant. So therefore, they must rule by means of deception. Because if they were to just go out and out and just say to you, yeah, we're going to steal all your stuff, you might have a thing or two to say about it. And so what must happen is an ideological false flag or an ideological psych on you and me. And this is exactly, I think, what we are seeing in the world. Now, it's certainly not true to say that this is a new development in a larger sense. I mean, human history has always been informed by hierarchy, intense hierarchy. On that sense, you could say mind control has always existed in the sense that elites have typically kind of created worldviews by which the great masses of humanity would look to the authority for guidance and for salvation. And I think the obvious example of this we could see is various religions of the world, but I would also include things like nationalism and other kinds of ideologies that, encourage and enforce compliance among the population. I think we can agree that false problems have, throughout human history, been kind of created in order to accommodate a prearranged solution to that problem. Things that I would call an ideological false flag. And what I mean by that is not an instance in which a government or an intelligence agency in ancient times would kill people and blame it on another party and scare the heck out of people and enforce their rule. No. But by creating a mindset. Think of something like the Inquisition. It's a perfect example of an ideological false flag where, you know, back in, I think it was 1487, a book called Malleus Maleficarum was published, and this was a guidebook, really, on how to identify, prosecute, and kill witches. That's what that book really was. And as a result of that, over the next century or so, about 1 million European women were executed for witchcraft. About that. And what that did, it did several things. One is it created a lot of fear among the population. Oh, my God, witches, get rid of those people. It enforced the authority of the ecclesiastical the church at the time, to at least for a certain while, until there was a reaction against that. And it also got a lot of power and money for the church. Families of witches would actually pay through indulgences to minimize the amount of time in purgatory or get them out of hell. This actually really happened. And it also allowed for land grabs by the church of the families of the witches, very much like the U.S. government does today with people suspected. This is really the truth, of various crimes. You know, they take your property. And so this is what the church did. So that's, I call, an ideological false flag. The war on terror is an ideological false flag, right? So that's an old, old part of human history. What I would say in our world today, there is a manner in which they're trying to get inside your head. All right, and I call it a propaganda spectrum. And so it goes from they're all kind of forms of control, but they get progressively more pernicious as you go down the list. So the most fundamental method by which society that you are expected to conform to society would be what we might call cultural values. And that's when you go to school and you learn to pledge allegiance with your hand over your heart. And you go through the educational system, which, even 100 years ago, Bertrand Russell was talking about as a method of conformity. More recently, we have really great visionaries like John Taylor Gatto, who has talked very much along the same lines of the educational system as a system of control over your head. Get inside your head and make you obey. Make you an obedient worker. So that's the cultural values. Not all of it is necessarily evil. I mean, we can all recognize that a functioning society would require a kind of cultural consensus, but you can still see how, the implementation of certain cultural values could at least provide a foundation of obedience. And beyond that, though, I think what is a little bit more pernicious is what we might call cultural distractions. And this is the phenomenon of the Kardashians. And, you know, things like dancing with whatever they got on this week, or Monday Night Football, or all the stupid, meaningless stuff that is poured into everyone's head every single day. Truly, literally meaningless information that just goes right in. And we all like entertainment. I'm watching back episodes of The Sopranos, so I'm just as guilty as anyone else. Those are my people. I'm from the Northeast. You know what I'm talking about? Yeah, I know what you're talking about. But I think, you know, when you get into a level of distraction that is so mindless as what we obviously see around us, this is a signal. It's a signal for you to look over here, don't look over there. There's something important going on over here, so look at this shiny little trinket. And it goes on and on and on and on, and it never stops. And it never will stop as long as this system is in place as it is. Beyond that, though, there's still always people, even in what we've been called ordinary, you know, out there society, all the other people in this country, who still want to feel like they're being informed. And that's when they turn on the TV and they watch CNN or Fox or NPR. Hey, why not? And so they believe that they're getting, because look, NPR was run for years and years by a man who was running CIA propaganda, and that's a fact. So NPR is really no different. Okay, NPR, you think, yeah, it's really true. People think, oh, I'm so educated. Fox sucks. I'm going to watch NPR. I'm going to listen to NPR because they're intelligent. Well, you know, here's the thing about that. I'll just say as an aside. We think, well, our whole cultural narrative these days, our whole cultural discourse in politics seems to me to be on nothing more than cultural issues. Not that they don't matter, but it's like if you're a liberal, that means I support transgender rights. If you're a conservative, I don't support transgender rights. I do support Black Lives Matter. I don't support Black Lives Matter. I do support smoking weed in Colorado. I don't support smoking. You know, if this is what we've come down to in our politics, we're done. It's over. Over. Stick a fork in us, it's done. Because there is, as I say, there's a serious war happening. It is a war of corporate cultural control and imposition of a global police state over you and over your children, over your grandchildren, for all of time. That's the war. And if we're not talking about that, then we're just wasting our time. That's my view. Anyway, so for that third level of control and spin, there's the news media, people who want to be informed. So they'll turn on CNN. And become confused forever. Because it's really, that's a system that is all about censorship, spin, propaganda control. CNN, why is it that CNN is on every single gate at every single airport in the United States? Why? What's is it like every airport manager in the country is like, oh, wow, I totally love CNN. I want to inform. Yeah, I don't think so. So they're a private company owned by Time Warner. Clearly, they're in a nice sweetheart deal. And because they are the propaganda voice of the U.S. State Department and CIA. That's the only reason they're on. Okay. That's the only reason you see them at every gate. So anyway, that's the third level. And I would say those first three levels of propaganda account for probably 95% of the control mechanisms in place to keep you in your place. Most probably. But then every now and then you need a little bit more something. And that's when we're talking about psyops, psychological operations, covert ops, color revolutions, regime change, down to the shock doctrine type of events. If anyone's read Naomi Klein, I'm a big fan of that book. And then down to false flags, which I think is the most pernicious of those. I'll talk a little bit about these in a little more detail. It's like with psyops, psychological operations, U.S. military, this is in their playbook. All right, this is an official thing that our military does, and other militaries do it too. It's not just us. And it's interesting that the Defense Department will have in this psychological operations manual three different types of ops. They call them white, gray, and black psyops. So white psyops is pretty straightforward. It's not really even a psych job on the world. It's basically an official or a virtually official statement of the United States government just getting their kind of message out to the world. And you know it's from the U.S. government, and it's relatively straightforward, even if you don't agree with it. Gray psyops is a little more interesting and very pervasive in our world today, as it's always been. If you're familiar with something like Operation Mockingbird, that would be a gray psyop. So that would be something like using journalists or using other voices that are not officially part of the U.S. government, but basically having them give the U.S. government perspective so that it, pretending is coming from some other voice. You know what I mean? That's a gray psyop. And that's a very, very widespread phenomenon. I mean, the Pentagon, for example, which spends billions of dollars every single year managing their social image, they do. That includes things like not simply having close relationships with professional journalists who spin the news in their favor, but it also includes paid trolls, which they call sock puppets. And this is true. Like, so you read news articles and you look at all the comments below and you see these real whack jobs out there. Well, some of them really literally are sock puppets. So that means you'd be a Pentagon employee and you'd be in charge of X number of profiles on the social media and on the message boards. That's what you would do. And you would disrupt, you would persuade, you would cajole. But in fact, you're a paid employee. So that would be a gray psyop as well.
You're listening to author and historian Richard Dolan. Today's show, Understanding False Flag Operations in Our Time. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. This is Guns and Butter.
And then there's black psyops. And this is where we're really getting into some serious stuff. So this is according to the U.S. Psychological Operations Manual. A black psyop is something that comes from a U.S. government source, but, quote, appears to emanate from a source hostile in nature. U.S. government would deny responsibility. So that's a false flag. I don't know how else you can describe it. Something that is that the U.S. government does, but seems to come from one of the bad guys. One of the things about black psyops in the manual is that at least they state that this is actually not a function of the United States military, but actually that black psyops are a function of the U.S. intelligence community. And that kind of makes sense. So I guess the point is that false flag black psyops are in the playbook of the United States. It's just worth keeping in mind. Something like regime change or the so-called color revolutions, these can include false flags, which I'm going to get into a false flag in just a moment, in case you're still wondering, what the heck is a false flag? Regime change is something that the United States has truly perfected to the extent possible over many decades. You know, they did it back in 1953 in Iran. And essentially what that was a CIA operation to overthrow an elected government that had the temerity to nationalize its oil. And you can't do that, so CIA, Kermit Roosevelt, a grandson of TR, ran an operation for the CIA to pay off people to pretend they were communists, to do horrible things to discredit that group, and to organize crowds that push for regime change. And it was quite successful. And this was a model that has been followed ever since. Primarily now what you find is the U.S. does this through NGOs, non-governmental organizations. And this has been a very, very major topic of study. So again, it's all ruled by indirection. There's one group known as Avaz, it's called The Voice in many languages, which has been many others as well. But this one has been heavily involved in supporting efforts to destabilize and topple the governments of Libya. They were really gleeful about that one and calling for NATO intervention, which ended up essentially destroying that nation, which it is to this day. And they're trying to do the same in Syria today. So in other words, the U.S. works through these and many other NGOs to push for regime change, where ordinary citizens, people around the world who don't know any better, think, oh, well, they're a non-governmental organization. They're obviously detached, objective, et cetera. No, they're not. They're working for the United States government and intelligence community. And this is very, very common. That's an image of the color revolution in Ukraine back in 2004. And it's just a model that's been done, tried and true many times now. Another aspect of the covert ops getting toward a false flag, in cases, what we might call provocations. And this has happened everywhere. So we're talking about agents provocateurs. You know, we've probably are all familiar with the old COINTELPRO operation by the FBI from the 50s and 60s and 70s, in which the FBI would infiltrate organizations that were pushing for positive social change, I would say, Students for a Democratic Society, the Black Panthers. And what they would do then is have their guys inside the organization fomenting violence and doing things to discredit those organizations. That's provocation. And this is, again, a highly effective tool used within the U.S., used in Canada, used in the U.K. It's used all through Europe. It was used very much in Ukraine in 2014, used in Iraq after the invasion in 03 through 04, 05, 06. There are a lot of provocations that we know about. I'll be writing about them in my new book, in Syria, elsewhere. And it happened in the Occupy movement, without a doubt. So you have covert operatives infiltrating movements for progressive change with a view to discredit it. I suspect most of you may be familiar with this or on board with it, but if you doubt it, this is a great deal of research and really excellent journalism that has gone into this and has, I think, proven, not suggested, not hinted, but has proven that provocations are standard operating procedure. Some of these guys just get found out. And then, another important means by which I think propaganda is used to dominate your mind and to kind of impose a corporate control, kind of a global revolution, is what we might call the shock doctrine technique. And this was the contribution of Naomi Klein. And really what she argues is that neoliberalism, or let's call it globalism, as a fundamentally anti-human process, her argument is that it can only be imposed via trauma, I guess we could say. She came to the phrase shock doctrine through the U.S. military's phrase of shock and awe. You know, the military goes into a nation, we're going to shock and awe them. I mean, think about, whoa, wow, what a thing to say about another group of people. You pound them into submission and traumatize them. And that's precisely U.S. military doctrine. And what it occurred to her was that this is actually how they rule, not just abroad, but they rule at home through shock. And she was thinking of Katrina. She was thinking of 9/11. When some horrible, terrible thing happens in which people are just bereft and no one's thinking clearly often after these horrific things happen. And that is exactly when she says contingency plans, which have been in place since forever, are rolled out and people just accept it because they're looking for help. Corporate control over New Orleans after Katrina, or the whole national security apparatus rolled in after 9/11, and so on and so on. And that's what she suggests is that these catastrophes and the anxiety that comes about as a result of it, that is played up by authorities, results in what she calls learned helplessness. So it's like, we've done science studies of rats, and you create so much anxiety and a loss of control, they learn helplessness, and it's the same with people. And her argument is that this is a key method by which global control is achieved. I would totally agree with that. And I would say, let's go one step further. There are instances in which crises aren't simply happening and then, you know, groups opportunistically take advantage of it. I would argue that there are a number of events in our contemporary world in which those catastrophes are intentionally created. And that is what we call a false flag. An instance in which a group, an intelligence agency, usually does something truly horrible, killing people, blowing up buildings, some other kind of horrific act that is then blamed on another party by which to justify things that could never otherwise be justified, whether it's dastardly pernicious laws of control over a population or wars that could never have otherwise be justified to justify theft of natural resources of other countries and so on. That's a false flag. And there's a lot of that going around in the world these days. I think it's probably the single most powerful form of propaganda. I can't think of anything that's has a more emotional impact than a false flag. And I also think there's not much more that I can think of as more risky or audacious or bold to undertake than a true false flag. So it's not something for everyone. I think it's something that only a very few organizations truly have the wherewithal and the power to implement. I'll get into that in a moment. If you scroll through the web on the phenomenon of false flags, you'll find a lot of sites that will say that this is an ancient phenomenon, you know, going back through. Some will cite things like Nero burning down Rome and blaming it on the Christians to implement certain things. And, you know, when I started researching this about a year ago, I was certainly inclined to accept that line of reasoning. But my own research has told me otherwise. And actually, I would argue that false flags are not an ancient phenomenon. Now, I talked about the ideological false flags, a kind of mind control system in place, like the Inquisition and other things. But that's different. I mean false flags as a covert op. I don't think that's an ancient phenomenon at all. I think it's a distinctively modern phenomenon. And in fact, I think that's an important thing to understand about them so that we realize why they are happening today. And I will be talking about that now. I think to have a false flag, what you need, because a false flag is a big psych job on the population. So one thing that is necessary is you have to have kind of an ostensibly, and I say ostensibly, democratic type of system. It doesn't have to be truly democratic. The United States is not a truly democratic society. In fact, Yale University, I think it was Yale, did a study a couple of years ago that actually quantitatively, I would say, proved that what we have is an oligarchy. And what they did is they looked at public policy and legislation that was implemented and looking at public opinion and like, and really, I think, proving beyond a shadow of a doubt that the wishes of the great masses of the population have zero impact on public policy, and that public policy is, on the contrary, put into place on the wishes of those who have power and money and influence. It's no surprise. That's an oligarchy. And that's what we have. But we also have an ostensive democratic system where people still believe, and we still have the remnants, let's say, of that kind of rule of the people. And it's not just the United States, it's in much of the world now. Kim Jong-un of North Korea doesn't need to do false flags. I mean, why? Yeah, really, why? Because he's got the people terrified. He just controls them through fear. And lies, yes, but a lie is not the same as a false flag. And in fact, he can't really do easily, in my view, a false flag against South Korea either, because he doesn't have control over major media globally. That's the next thing. All right. So for a false flag, you need an ostensibly democratic system so that you can, because you have to corral the people into a particular point of view, right? And then you need control over major media. You have to have the ability to propagandize, effectively propagandize, without competition from other narratives, at least significant competition of that. So you dominate the narrative. On top of that, you need decent covert op teams, people who know what they're doing. Again, this is not the type of thing that you would really find in the ancient world. You need a lot of money to do that, and there's a few nations that in the world today who have much more money and means than others to do this. And you need motive and the capability, obviously, for what I would call geopolitical, financial, or national political change. There's got to be groups that are pushing to revolutionize their society in ways that they believe it should be. They realize they can't do it along legal means, and so they use these other means. The other one thing I would say why false flags are not a truly ancient phenomenon is, I mean, look, the ancient world, and I'm an avid student of ancient history, very much so. What you find in ancient history is lots of bloodshed. I mean, massacres and horrific, just, you know, we think it's bad today, but the ancient world, armies would go in and just completely kill every single inhabitant in a town. My God. So there's no shortage of bloodshed. There's no shortage of lies that nations would tell each other, absolutely. But the idea of doing something like a false flag in the ancient world, when you look at most of the cultural values that existed in most of the societies back then, it really would be pernicious to them. As bloody-minded as most of the ancient militaries were, there was a sort of code, let's call it a code among thieves or a code of honor, in which the deception really would be considered a pernicious and a horrible thing to do. And also, I think it would be much more difficult to do a true false flag for those reasons and for simply the lack of communication, it's just a harder thing to do. And I think a false flag is, again, a distinctively modern phenomenon.
You're listening to author and historian Richard Dolan. Today's show, Understanding False Flag Operations in Our Time. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. This is Guns and Butter.
Yeah, so to do a false flag internationally, or even domestically and have it fly internationally, you need power in the world today. You've got to be able, especially for something international, you've got to dominate global media, at least sufficiently that, you know, you can sort of push aside alternative narratives and explanations. And you've also have to have the ability to intimidate other nations into silence if you're going to do this. And there are very few nations that have that ability in the world today. I'm going to do a little bit, and just a, and there's no way and I'm going to be able to go over every single thing that I think has been a false flag in the last 100 years. There's a lot of things. But I do want to give a kind of sense of how the phenomenon has evolved. False flags have evolved. My own research at this point is telling me that the true phenomenon really takes off following the First World War. Again, there are isolated events, possibly, maybe probably, from prior to World War I, but not many. Even talking about the sinking of the Maine, I've looked into that, and I'm not really sure that I would classify that as a true false flag. It can go either way. But we start seeing them now for sure in the 1930s. And really the main nations that were doing them, Japan, Germany, Soviet Union, they did some very prominent ones. Now these, and you know, I think many of us are familiar with some of these. Everyone's heard of the Reichstag fire. The German invasion of Poland is maybe one of the classic international false flags of all time. Essentially, Germans took a bunch of political prisoners who were rotting away in the prison system, dressed them in Polish military uniforms, took over a radio station at the border, shot all of the prisoners, posed one of them at a microphone, and then went on the air and pretended that Poland had attacked Germany and was inciting Poles in Germany to resist Hitler. And so this was an absolute false flag. The German people, as far as we can tell, more or less accepted it. International politicians were not particularly impressed by it, to say the least, but it worked enough for the Germans to justify to themselves that they invaded. False flag. That's the Reichstag, by the way, burning. That's their 9/11. The thing that they all have in common, those false flags of that decade, is that those were nations with state control over the media. That's a very important thing to keep in mind. And they also had very, very sophisticated military intelligence groups for their time, without a doubt. So they had the control over the media, and they had the teams, and they were militarized. And this is, I think, why after World War I we start seeing it. World War I militarized all of Europe and the United States, and really transformed those cultures to that extent. And so that there was a very strong militarization in the aftermath of that, and I think that was part of it. What you find after the Cold War is that the United States wins the false flag Olympics, hands down. Hands down, and it's really been ever since. I would say that the U.S. and its vassal states essentially run the false flag universe. It's basically U.S., Israel, U.K., I would say, are the big three. There are certainly other nations that have been involved in this, without a doubt, particularly since 9/11. A lot of nations have jumped on board. In the immediate aftermath of 9/11, a lot of them did it in order to get U.S. terror funding. There was a case, I think in 02, that was found out, this one, the nation of Macedonia found out that they had murdered seven immigrants, illegal immigrants from Pakistan, and said that these are Al-Qaeda terrorists. They were not Al-Qaeda terrorists. They were illegals, but they were, you know, innocent people. They were killed, and the Macedonian authorities played it up as Al-Qaeda specifically in order to get U.S. funding. And they're not the only example of that type of shenanigans. Kind of a piling on effect after 9/11. But back to the Cold War, what you see is a transformation of the false flags in the sense that they start becoming domestic. All right, there's still international incidents that are false flags, absolutely. There was one that was found out by the Israelis in 1954 where Mossad was basically finding Egyptian Jews who were going to blow up certain buildings and blame it on the Muslim Brotherhood, and it was found out, and it was called a Lavon affair after the Israeli defense minister, parties involved, confessed and all of that. That was an international type of false flag. They did that, incidentally, to prevent the British or to encourage the British not to leave, abandon the Suez Canal. But primarily what you see are domestic false flags specifically for political control. COINTELPRO in the U.S. is maybe a classic example of that. The FBI doing what they call black bag jobs and the like to dirty tricks, smearing people, doing events, blaming it on other organizations, and so on. In Europe, probably the most pernicious was known as Operation Gladio, which was a NATO/CIA operation. Essentially, when the World War II concluded, there was the fear among Allied nations that the Russians would roll over Europe, and so there were teams put in place in Europe to act as a kind of a resistance if this were to happen. Well, the Russians did not roll over Western Europe, and these teams are still sitting there. And in Italy, they got the bright idea of killing people and blowing up buildings and train stations and blaming it on the communists, which they did for years, years and years. This has been found out. And in fact, one of the Gladio operatives, Vincenzo Vinciguerra, who was serving life in prison for his part in Gladio, in an interview, it was very explicit. He said the point of what we were doing was to force these people, the Italian people in this case, to turn to the state and ask for greater security. They're very upfront about it. But these were NATO operatives with the knowledge of the higher-up authorities, and they were just doing this. They'd blame their murders on the Red Brigade and blame them on other left-wing groups. So there's a long proven history. This is another list of the 60s and in the 70s and 80s, and I'm not going to go over all of it. It includes the Gulf of Tonkin. It includes some really nasty Mossad operations, some of which looked exactly like Charlie Hebdo, one of which occurred in 1982, bombing of a Jewish delicatessen in Paris. Sound familiar? But it was 1982. When French intelligence investigated far enough, they kind of ran into a brick wall and everything stopped. And it did get some very good international analysis at the time. One of the more pernicious ones would be during the ramp up to the Persian Gulf War. You remember this? I bet some of you do. The incubator hoax. This woman was actually the daughter of the Kuwaiti ambassador to the United States, but she was pretending to be a nurse on TV and to Congress. And what she said was that the Iraqi troops, once they had gone into Kuwait, remember that? Were looting incubators from a Kuwaiti hospital, leaving the premature babies to die on the floor. And it was such a horrific image. This went on all the news. Everyone promoted this, from NPR to Fox and everyone in between. It's a total lie, and she was a total lie. But this is how it works. But in fact, by the 80s and 90s, the United States military was officially hiring public relations firms in a very effective way. The Persian Gulf War was kind of a watershed in that effort. But let's keep going here. And then through the 90s, you've got quite a few of these. The Oklahoma City bombing is probably the most prominent one there. I'll talk about some of the problems of how to identify these types of false flags when I close. As we get to the 21st century, I think we hit the era of true false flags. And I'm not going to go into the specifics. It's just too much. I want to talk about the geopolitics and to help us understand why this is happening. I think one of the key things has to do with globalization. With globalization, you get economic disruption and the loss of jobs. This is Seattle, 1999. I think Seattle is a great indicator. These are the WTO riots or protests. November 30th, this went for 4 days into early December. This is significant. Back in 1999, Americans still believed they had rights. I remember those days. And the WTO, the World Trade Organization, was convening in Seattle at that time. And for several months, protesters planned this out. And when that convention happened, these protesters, at minimum 40,000, probably much more, shut that city down. They shut it down. They were so effective. The delegates were not able to enter the premises for the longest time. Police, tear gas didn't work, pepper spray didn't work. The police were overwhelmed by an incredibly powerful public reaction. And this is what happens when the public feels empowered. And the WTO was really initiating some very nasty decisions that, in fact, they ended up doing that just accelerated the process of the deindustrialization of the United States. But this is when people were saying, no, we're not going to put up with it. Of course, 18 months later, we have 9/11, in which the hammer comes down and beats you over the head for the rest of your life with a big national security stick. And so that people learn to duck their head and not speak up. Because bad idea now. You know, we now have, I think, 20% of the American population is 15 or younger. I think that's the number. These are people who grew up. They don't know anything other than post 9/11 America. And actually, let's say that anyone who's under 25 really doesn't. I mean, they were kids. So that's probably, what, a third or more of the population. It's all going away. The whole past of the United States, the whole idea of rule by the people, of privacy. We have an entire new generation. They're growing up without any of that. It's all gone. It's almost, for some of these young people, it's almost, I hate to say it, but it almost seems meaningless. I have two brilliant young teenagers, 19 and 17, and I know many of their friends. They're a little different. They're kind of plugged in. But I know about a lot of young people. They just live, you know, post their stuff on Facebook. They don't care about privacy. They don't expect it. It's a different world. And I think this type of thing is a threat to the globalist process and is a trigger for false flags. The other major geopolitical thing behind false flags, I would suggest to you, is the petrodollar system. And I can't go over the whole thing here, but essentially this is a deal worked out between Henry Kissinger and the King of Saudi Arabia in the early 70s to keep the dollar in place as the reserve world currency. The dollar had just gone off the gold standard, whole story behind that, and now they wanted to hook the dollar to petroleum. And really what Kissinger was able to agree was to have all the OPEC nations sell their oil only in dollars. And that's the foundation of American policy to this day. So all of the nations would get their oil pegged in dollars. It's great for the U.S. because it allows that there's a global demand for our currency, which allows for all kinds of things that the U.S. can do, printing up trillions of dollars and basically holding the world hostage as a result. No other nation could afford to do what the U.S. is doing to prosecute all of its wars and the like because of the petrodollar system. And it is a foundation of America's empire. And it's really never discussed, never ever discussed in mainstream media. But the petrodollar system forces, these geopolitics force U.S. neoconservatives, which is simply another word for empire builder. Neoconservative. Think about that word. You know, old conservative. What would be an old conservative? Someone who I would think would want to conserve the traditional Republican values and institutions of this country. That's not the worst thing in the world. A neoconservative is something, a new conservative. They're conserving not the Republic, my friends. They're conserving the empire. That's what a neoconservative is. They are building and conserving empire. You can be a Republican like Dick Cheney, and you can be a Democrat like Hillary Clinton. And you can be a neoconservative. They're twins. They're brother and sister twins, politically, in my opinion. They both are as equally intent on domination and preservation of the United States empire. And that forces the neocons, the whole petrodollar system, to demonize any of these people who are not on board with that system. So this is why Saddam went away, because he started selling his oil in euros in 2000. And Gaddafi, with the gold-based dinar system he was about to introduce, which was a threat to the dollar. And Putin, of course, who is simply, well, long story about Vlad. We'll have to skip that for another time. I'm fascinated by Russian politics, always have been.
You're listening to author and historian Richard Dolan. Today's show, Understanding False Flag Operations in Our Time. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. This is Guns and Butter.
It forces the United States to feel the need to physically control the sources of energy that exist, basically the hydrocarbons that go from basically Western Africa across the continent to the Middle East into Western Asia. That's two-thirds of the world's oil and natural gas right there. And the U.S. wants it all. They want to control it physically. These are the geopolitical reasons, I would argue, that are directly behind 9/11. you know, to steal, say, you know, $30 trillion worth of oil under the ground in Iraq, which they did, and then sold off to multinationals. And to steal all the nice mineral wealth under the ground in Afghanistan as a nice little bonus. So theft, of course, is always important for this. And then to control the population. All right. So, and I would suggest, too, that the petrodollar and all of this other, this is all part of a hierarchical-based and scarcity-driven system. That is, energy is scarcity. Energy in our world today is based on physical control over a particular commodity, oil and natural gas primarily. And if you control those locations, you control the distribution, you have the power. All right. And that's a strength and a power of the system, but it's also the weakness of the system. Because if we develop a alternative energy paradigm, this is very much in danger. And that's a good thing. So they're vulnerable to, this whole system is vulnerable to emerging technologies. And that means that the false flag phenomenon itself would be vulnerable to that. I'm going to give you a quick profile. Like, you know, we talk about racial profiling by the police. Let's talk about false flag profiling. There's certain things that, you know, by themselves or even collectively don't prove that something is a false flag, but they give you an idea that you want to look carefully at it. The only way to, you know, to prove one thing or another is through good investigative journalism. But nonetheless, let's just take a quick look at some of these things. So one thing to look for is that it's a sensational event that gets a lot of major media attention, boom, immediately. That's pretty obvious. But what you really want to look for are changing narratives. So in other words, particularly in the beginning, in the first day or two of an event, you will find, you will always find competing narratives of what exactly happened. And that's, you really want to look for that, because after a few days, that goes away. And the major media particularly are on board with, boom, the story, and this is the only story. Yeah, San Bernardino is a great case. This happened not long ago, and, you know, there were several witnesses, who said, I saw three big white guys come in with guns. Now, I don't know if that's the case or not, but that's the fact. These witnesses said this. That's just one example. And with 9/11, there's all kinds of alternative narratives. You have the case of Rumsfeld talking about the plane that got shot down over Pennsylvania. Whoops, maybe I didn't mean to say that. And on and on and on. There's all of these competing different statements that get leaked out and then just go away. So you want to look for that. You also want to look for the fact that the case is quickly closed, that a patsy or the evildoer is quickly found and usually is either killed immediately, or if he's not killed, he just disappears. And then the trial is always a kangaroo court, and you never even hear what's going on. Boston is a great example of that. Another thing you want to look for is that these suspects are connected to intelligence groups, whether U.S. or non-U.S., but frequently U.S. I would say this. If you are approached by the FBI ever in your life and your skin color is maybe a shade or two darker than mine, you better run far and fast. I'm not kidding. Because what they do, the FBI goes after foreign nationals who look foreign, that is, i.e. they're a little darker. And they love to set these people up. More than half of all the terrorist arrests post 9/11 that have to do with federal terrorism charges, they're FBI setup jobs. So the FBI will approach you, they'll convince you, oh yeah, the U.S. government, they suck, let's go get them. And in particular, if you're not that bright, if you're very easily impressionable, this happened in my town of Rochester just a couple of weeks ago. They got another one there. They will bring you to the store to get your terrorist equipment, like a knife or a ski mask. And I'm serious. And then they'll arrest you, and you'll never see daylight ever again. You know, these people on their own would almost never have committed any of these crimes. So this is provocation. This is what our government does to us. All right? So if the FBI comes up to you, no matter what you look like, run. Go away from these people. But what you find is that these suspects, there's often a connection to intelligence organizations. So typically the suspects that are promoted in the media have some kind of connection sociologically, demographically, to whatever group is to be demonized. Back in the 90s, it was typically right-wing militias, gun nuts, that type of thing. You know, Timothy McVeigh comes to mind. Our century, it's more Muslims. They seem to be the group they're going after. But there's others. The LAX shooting was a so-called right-wing conspiracy theorist. is how he was portrayed in the media, and so on and so on. So look for these. One thing you really want to look for are unanswered questions and just problems associated with the official explanation of the event. There's often gaping holes in these things that the media, the establishment media, that is, never asks. How did these guys get out of Charlie Hebdo shooting so easily? There's a card, like, no one bothered them. How is it that they talked about a pristine passport being found after 9/11 and then also after the Paris murders just a few months ago? And really, a pristine passport? In the case of the Paris shooting, this perfect Syrian passport was left behind. What? Really? Then that story kind of went away and is not talked about. Changing narratives. These are very suspicious things. And, you know, whatever the truth is behind this, maybe we'll never find the truth of some of these incidents, because who knows why. But we certainly ought to be asking the questions. Multiple drills is important. This is a key thing. When the events happen, you typically find there are multiple drills happening that portray the exact same thing. With 9/11, there was a drill going on that day to protect America against the attack by terrorists using airplanes to crash into us. I'm not kidding. And there are a number of these multiple drills with the shootings and other things. Why would that be? Here's why. In the intelligence community, when you're planning this thing out, there are always people who are not in with the in crowd. They're not on board. The idea of the multiple drills is to provide cover. So if someone sees that this is happening, the answer is, oh, no, we're doing a drill. We're doing a drill. See? But then it happens. And the other thing is that the existence of the drills also provides confusion during the day when the false flag occurs, and that is very helpful for the operation. And the other thing you just see is a media narrative that jumps right on top because there's an intimate collaboration. You know, the discussions inevitably focus on, oh, do we need more police protection, greater police state measures? Well, what about our privacy? Yeah, but we have to have security. And that whole discussion just goes on and on. And so the conversation, the public conversation, inevitably creeps toward fascism. Always does. And war. Fascism and war. And then finally, you find the government taking action and doing things, again, that could never be justified, whether it's invading Iraq or whether it's rolling out the naked body scanners owned by Michael Chertoff's company after the underwear bomber. Ooh, underwear bomber. And, you know, sweetheart deals that happen that would never have happened otherwise. Now, it's true. Some of these events may not be always false flags. They might be devious, evil opportunism run amok. Would not rule that out. But a lot of these, I think, are indeed false flags. Absolutely. And we need to look at it. Finally, concluding, I would say that a lot of these false flags are not necessarily going to be military operations, especially moving forward. I think we need to look for corporate and financial false flags. In fact, there have been financial false flags in the past. I'll write about the 1907 financial crisis that led to the establishment of the Federal Reserve. And I think that we have financial false flags that are going on in our own era. We have corporate false flags. Everyone remembers the Sony North Korea hack, absolute corporate slash intel false flag, the flu scares, the pharmaceutical, all of these, I think, are a big part of our world today. And keeping in mind, too, not every false flag, in fact, no false flag likely is going to be on the magnitude of something like 9/11. That's the granddaddy, the big one. Most other false flags will have varying levels of impact on the world. Think of them as different types of different size weapons to target different types of things that they want to get done. I just want to wrap up. I think there's a way out. What we're seeing, the false flag phenomenon is important right now because you have groups that are trying right now to establish a global totalitarian system. And they are trying very, very hard using false flags as a way to psych us out, terrify us, make us feel helpless so that we run to the state for protection. You can see it happening. This is exactly what they're moving toward. And they're very, very successful at it right now. So in that war, we have to expect all forms of propaganda to be ramped up and to be in place, including the false flag, but not exclusively false flags. All the tricks of the trade are coming out. The way out for us, obviously, educate ourselves. Be unafraid to be an activist. I keep thinking, find out what you're willing to go to jail for. Think about this. What are the things that you personally are willing, would be willing to be arrested for? Because we're getting to that point. What will we support that in organizations like WikiLeaks, which technically do things that are illegal, but we need them? Because we're not living in a democratic system. We're living in an authoritarian system masking as a democratic system. Fascism today is not going to look like Hitler. All right, that was 80 years ago. This isn't the world of the 1930s. Fascism's not going to look like brown shirts raising their right hand. It's not how it is. Fascism's going to look a lot sexier. It'll look like, you know, Monday Night Football, and it'll look like Dancing with the Stars, and it'll look like all those nice things that people like to look at, the glitter. And it'll call itself democracy. But it's not going to call itself fascism. Of course it won't. So we have to be aware. And the other thing that researchers should be doing, and they are doing this, we're seeing this with the web, is they're calling out false flag opportunities now when they happen. This is not the case 20 years ago. It's happening now. When any big event happens, you see it. Now, sometimes people just jump on and say, false flag, and maybe not always with evidence, but researchers are very, very aware now. And so it's becoming a little more difficult. The main thing I feel we need to do, though, is to break out of this hierarchical control system. I was talking about energy earlier. I think there are ways for us moving forward technologically and in terms of our own thinking to break ourselves out of this system of energy control. We're talking about things like energy harvesting devices, free energy, and the like. I think this is important. The other thing, I do write about UFOs and the ET, let's call it the ET phenomenon. I do consider that probably the greatest and most deepest dark secret that we have in our world today. It represents an infrastructure that is so vastly beyond the infrastructure we're looking at here. And I do think that the opening of that secret, as well as other secrets, would cause an effect for people to be peering into the structures of power and allow them to take, or at least begin the process of taking back power, taking back our own sovereignty, so that we can live actually as we always wanted to, as free, independent citizens of a society that believes in rule by the people.
There's something happening here. Yeah, yeah. What it is ain't exactly clear. There's a man.
You've been listening to Richard Dolan. Today's show has been Understanding False Flag Operations in Our Time. Richard Dolan is an author and historian. He is nearing completion of a groundbreaking book, A History of False Flag Operations, which will explain one of the most pernicious developments of our time, how clandestine agencies secretly engage in violence and destruction in order to promote their agendas. He is best known as the author of two volumes of history, UFOs and the National Security State. He is widely regarded as a leading researcher and historian on the topic of the UFO cover-up. He studied U.S. Cold War strategy, Soviet history, and international diplomacy. Since 2012, he has hosted The Richard Dolan Show, airing on KGRA Radio every Monday evening from 8 to 10 p.m. Eastern. In addition to his research, his company, Richard Dolan Press, actively publishes innovative books by authors from around the world. Visit his website at richarddolanpress.com. Guns and Butter is produced by Bonnie Faulkner, Yaro Mako, and Tony Rango. To leave comments or order copies of shows, email us at faulkner@gunsandbutter.org. That's F-A-U-L-K-N-E-R at G-U-N-S-A-N-D-B-U-T-T-E-R.org. Visit our website at gunsandbutter.org to sign up for our email list and receive our newsletter. Follow us at G&B Radio.
Evolution of the mind. If you seek, then you shall find that we all come from the divine. You dig what I'm saying? Now, if you take heed to the words of wisdom that are written on the walls of life, then you.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical. Your online antidote to corporate media crap. Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next,
New World Notes.
Welcome to New World Notes, hosted by Kenneth Doust. We return with part two of Michael Parenti's fine speech in Springfield, Illinois, of October 16, 2015. It's called Capitalism versus Reality. It's a fascinating and brilliant talk. Enjoy.
The capitalist state, and that's what we live under a government that works in a capitalist system. The capitalist state has two core functions. The first is to maintain and advance capital accumulation. That is, the companies, the corporations have to keep making their money, and that process of them accumulating wealth has to be protected. And it's being protected very well. In the last 10 years, all the new wealth that has been produced, all of it went to the top 1%, 1 or 2%. And when I talk about capitalism and such, I'm talking about the giant corporations. I'm not talking about mom-and-pop small businesses, because all I can say is I'm not talking about them. Lenin was right. He said 10 million small businesses count for nothing. A few giant cartels count for everything. A cartel is like the oil cartel, which would be made up of Exxon and Mobil. And they collude together and they divvy out the market and they play with the prices and the like. Small business, like I call it, the squirrels dancing among the elephants. And you know what happens? The squirrels would dance among elephants. Have you ever seen it? No, you haven't. But they tend to get smashed and squashed. I've been accused of being soft on small businesses, and that's true, I am. As individuals, capitalism does not usually bring out the best in us. We face too many ugly necessities created by the competitive dog-eat-dog system. Unfortunately, capitalism best rewards the worst part of us: ruthless, competitive, conniving, opportunistic, exploitative, acquisitive drives. Private enterprise, as it's sometimes called, gives little reward and often much punishment, or at least much handicap, to honesty, compassion, many forms of hard work, cooperative and collective effort, love of justice and fair play, and a concern for those most in need. There was a great labor union leader who later became a noted socialist leader, American, named Eugene Victor Debs from Indiana. And Debs remarked with bitter irony that to the extent that that life in an advanced capitalist state is made bearable or decent, barely decent, it's because of the humanizing effects of democratic struggle and labor struggle. And Debs started figuring all this out while he was in jail. He was leading the railroad strike and all that, and he got beaten up and thrown in jail. I've been beaten up by police and thrown in jail. And let me tell you, when you get slammed in the jail and slammed against the bars and thrown in there and they lock it up, you have time to think, you know. You really sort of sit there and you say, what is going on? What is this all about? wait a minute, where's the Stars and Stripes and all that stuff? Nobody's singing. And Debs was sitting there, and he's saying, this is crazy. Why are the cops on the side of the big bosses? Why aren't the cops out there on the side of the workers? We are the people of society. We're the people who do all those jobs. And then he began to realize that the state is not neutral. That state is not neutral. If there's a disruption and this and that, the state comes out and they start serving the powers that be. But Debs was making this other point, which I thought was very interesting, that the more successful we are, we pull down certain, you know, increases and betterment in wages and this or that and this and that. We make life a little bearable, more bearable. We cut our 14-hour day to a 13-hour day. That's a little bit better, you know. Whatever, we try to make this society more human, we are legitimating it. And what we really should be doing is telling the people, look, this isn't for us at all. This is a society that's heartless and inhumane, and we're making it somewhat a little more humane. We create little patches of community and democratic distribution in which we try to live. Is capitalism not a successful economic system? It has success. It is the envy of the world, what we have in America. Well, it really isn't. It depends on your position in the social order. Let's start with capitalist leaders. Nancy Pelosi, Congresswoman, Democratic Party, Speaker of the House, in 2008, at the end of George W. Bush's term, she says, Bush is a complete failure on every policy area. I would argue Bush was a smashing success in almost every policy area. Bush himself didn't hold back in his personal praise. He said, and I think he was right, absolutely right, he said he accomplished everything he could do within the strictures of the presidential office, except two things. He failed to undo Social Security. That means pensions, dependency, and disability. That's what Social Security covers. If something bad happens to you, you will not be left to just lie in the street. You do get some support. It's a socialist program. That's socialism at work. And they are dedicated, the conservatives are dedicated to eliminating it every chance they can get, or nibble away at it, or break it down, minimize it. Bush also pointed out that he brought in, well, no, he doesn't point it out. I'm pointing it out, what Bush did. I'm sorry. Bush had provided massive increases in the military budget, a military budget that went from $250 billion to something like $526 billion. Today, under Obama, it's closer to $1 trillion a year. $1 trillion a year. Some of that money comes from the Energy Department. Some of it comes from other things. Some of it comes from these other wars that are then slapped onto this budget as an extra budget. Massive shifts in tax burden to the working class and middle classes, cutbacks and defunding and deregulation of human services, including public education and environmental protections, massive debt, which helps to defund government, kill these programs, not because they don't work, but because they do. That's why they want to get rid of Social Security, not because it doesn't work, but because it does. It's been about the best check on poverty, elderly poverty, that we've had. Capitalism is less successful in the more prosperous countries. That is, a country that is prosperous, like Finland, Norway, Denmark, Sweden. These are the social democracies. After World War II, they faced the Red Army along the Elbe River. They faced all of Eastern Europe was now communist. All these communist countries were now providing Social Security, old age pensions, supports, guaranteed right to a job to every worker, free medical care to every worker. This was going on in the communist countries. Subsidized rent and housing. No worker could spend more than, I think it was 15% of his salary on rent. So you were guaranteed, you didn't have to put all your money on your housing. these kind of things were very embarrassing. And after World War II, you had a very strong social democratic parties, including some communists, voting and bringing in governments that did these generous human services for all, more equitable tax system, consumer and worker protections, excellent utility and transportation services, and then all the things I just mentioned about the other social democracies. But social democracies are recent, and they're never really secure. Look what's happened in the United Kingdom. It's rolling back now since Tony Blair. They've been undermining it and cutting it back, and the Brits are paying more and more and getting less and less for it. And there are cutbacks all through Western Europe because there's no more Eastern Europe. There's no more communism. The Red Army's gone. The big communist parties in France and Italy are pretty much gone. So the guys at the top no longer have to make frightened concessions to the mass of the people. In contrast to the social democracies of Western Europe, I mean, they're still pretty good. They're better than what we've got. I mean, if you were ill, you're much luckier to be ill in Finland than in the United States. Capitalism is a more complete success in countries like Indonesia, Nigeria, Colombia, El Salvador, places like that. That's where. Let's take Indonesia. And by successful, I mean more successful in serving that 1% at the very top. They don't have to kick back for all these regulations and all these human services and such. In Indonesia, there's no customer service or warranties on commodities. Drinking water is privatized and unclean. You have to buy drinking water, and you got to hope it's clean. No public health services, no environmental protections, chaotic auto traffic, regular bus plunges, buses going off because roads are so poorly graded and unfixed, rampant crime, terrible poverty. But the rich, the rich in Indonesia, they live so well. They live in such lush luxury. They have small armies of servants who serve them. And the servants are de facto slaves. And if the servant doesn't want to serve and wants a day off or wants that, he or she can be kicked out. And there'll be five other people waiting at the gate to come in and serve. And so that's the kind of world that the capitalists want, a world of billionaires who can call their shots and the rest of us lining up with bowed head. Capitalism makes a claim not only to democracy, but to prosperity. Not true. The goal is private wealth for the few and public poverty for the many. And that's what I was saying about Indonesia and the like. The poorer and hungrier you are, the harder you will work for less and less. And the more surplus value I, the boss, can extract from you. Free enterprise and competition are widely celebrated as part of the dynamic and abundance of capitalism. In fact, the corporate enterprise system almost always is in a state of crisis. Even in the USA, abnormality is normality. Recessions, 1780s, terrible recessions, terrible fights about rent, land rents and taxes and such. It led to Shays' Rebellion, and Shays' Rebellion led to the Constitutional Convention. They hurried together to whip together a stronger government to stop this kind of thing. 1805, panic. 1820s, recessions. 1850, market crashes. 1873, a whole decade of depression. Another whole decade, 1890s, Teddy Roosevelt, 1896, saying, this country needs a war, any war. And he got it in 1898, which was what? The Spanish-American War. 1920s were a recession time. I never learned that. We always learned the 1920s were what? The jazz age, right? The roaring 20s, they were called. Charleston. With very little inducement from you, I can do the Charleston, right? But I won't. This went on through the whole 1920s. You know where the recession was in the 1920s? It was mostly in rural areas, which is probably why it could go undetected. But in the rural areas, it was very hard on people, both black and white. Then at the end of that decade, in October 1929, came the great crash of the stock market, and the depression came. That depression lasted from 1929 to 1941. It ended in 41-42 because the U.S. was now in a major global war against Japan and Germany. 1941. This is where you got to take a look more closely, because this is where this explains the great American prosperity, and it did come around that time. I remember my uncle Nick and my dad and my uncle Joe all talking and moaning about how the war is going to be over fairly soon, and we're going to be hit with a terrible depression again. I said, why? I always used to hear about this thing called the depression. You're surprised to know I was even alive then. I look so young, don't I? You thought I was like, like 35 or 40, I know. Okay, yeah, right. They understood that 9 million young American men and some tens of thousands of women are going to come back out of uniform and come back into the economy. There's going to be no jobs. Where are all the jobs going to be? See, the Depression ended in 41 because the U.S. was ready to really spend. They spent deficit spending. They spent enormous amounts of money to do in war what they would never do in peace, which was to build all these planes and tanks and whatever else. But when the war was over, these 9 million of these people who came back entered the GI Bill of Rights, GI Bill. The GI Bill was a tremendous program. It brought to every veteran from the war could go back to school, and he would get a full stipend and a full payment of his tuition fees, also a scholarship. Or others could start small businesses, and others could do all sorts of other kinds of things. It turned out to be one of the most economically terrific things. GI veterans who hadn't finished high school are now becoming accountants who are going on into other professions. It actually enriched the whole economy terrifically. Another thing that happened was all during the war, people like my Uncle Nick, who used to make $50 a week as a garage mechanic, he quit being that during the war, and he went to work in a war factory, and making planes and this and that. So you had people now doing all this kind of work, and coming away with lots of money. The trouble is they had nothing to buy. I remember that too during the war. Everything was rationed. So you had all this money now, but you couldn't buy. The factories were no longer making electric toasters or refrigerators or cars or anything like that, or houses. The factories were making planes and tanks, and you couldn't buy a tank, and you didn't have much use for a tank anywhere. So you had this immense backlog of buying power, and that's really one of the problems of recessions is, of course, you haven't paid your workers enough money to buy back the goods and services that they're producing, and that's why you have a recession. So all of that was changing, the GI Bill and then this, and from 1947 to, I would say, 1979, 1981, during the last 2 years of Carter, where he started selling out, and the introduction of Ronald Reagan coming in, up until that time, that's the immense prosperity you got, building of suburbia, building of highways, the kind we, everything you see and take for granted now, freeways and highways, all those things, they didn't exist back when I was graduating from school. When we heard that the Pulaski Highway in Jersey, did you hear about it? You can go 60 miles an hour. Wow, 60 miles an hour. Yeah, a mile a minute. Well, that's only 60 miles an hour. What's so fast about that? We learned later on as more and more cars came out and this and that. So there was this kind of backlog of consumer hunger, a consumer hunger that's backed by money, by ability to buy for it. That became the basis of the great prosperity, a prosperity which is now eluding us, a prosperity which is declining and declining. You hear reports about 20,000 more new jobs, people, but they don't tell you about the quality of the jobs, the paying of the jobs, the durability of it. As part of the myth of prosperity, the Horatio Alger myth, as you know it, the view that every generation is more prosperous than the previous one. It just isn't so. In the last 20 years, all the new wealth created went to the top 2 or 3%. In the last 20 years, the rest of us have worked harder and stayed much in the same place. And if you're working harder and harder to stay in the same place, you're not staying in the same place. Our national debt is greater and greater. It's up to, what, $17 trillion now? We, the taxpayers, owe that. The national debt belongs to us. Karl Marx made that point in Kapital, Volume 1, where he said, of all the things in society, the one thing that belongs to the people is the national debt. They own it. They'll be taxed. They have to pay it. And they pay it to those who own all those U.S. bonds, those national bonds and such, which are the rich. This recession that we've been living in now, the 2008-09 one is still going on 2015. These recessions, it's like all recessions, it has certain advantages, not for us, but for the 1%, the people at the very top. It wipes out weaker competitors. It allows mergers at more affordable costs, concentrations. Marx called that one capitalist. The phrase was, one capitalist will kill many capitalists. Back in 1910, there must have been 20 or 30 auto factories, auto businesses arising. About 13 of them provided electric cars, believe it or not. The electric cars got wiped out, though. And the others came in. By the great prosperity, we're talking now no longer about businesses, we're talking about giant corporations. You had only three auto companies, right? Ford, Chrysler. Who was the third one? General Motors, the biggest. I forgot it. Yeah, General Motors, right. Thank you. And that's the way it is with the oil companies. That's the way it was with the meat packing companies. There must have been about 200 meat packing companies. To play safe, I'll say by World War I or by 1920, that had broken down to Armour and Swift and one or two others, about four or five of them. I'm thinking of the book, The Triumph of Conservatism. And it was about that turn of the century where the cartels and these few big companies took over. And it happens all the time. I think it happened with computers, didn't it? I mean, there were all sorts of little companies starting up. People's garages and this and that. And then it gets back down to, what, three or four companies, giant companies with billions of dollars. That doesn't mean that these big companies don't take money from the government. They do. They don't want you to take money from the government. They don't want you to get food stamps. They don't want you to get rent subsidies. But they take money. They take billions every year. They take over land, for instance. What the Pentagon does with McDonnell Douglas, right? Well, they'll give him the land, they'll give him the materials, they can build the factory, and then they can produce whatever new jet or new rocket or new instrument of death is needed. And this is all done compliments of the taxpayers. The goal of giant global capitalism is the third worldization, not only of the U.S. economy, but of the entire world. I've written books on that. The U.S. global military machine undermines any country, any government, any leader that uses the land, labor, capital, and natural resources for the development of their own country. So we have not only public suppression and impoverishment at home, but we got it around the entire globe, with wars 2, 3, 4 at a time, military bases, hundreds of them around the world. The empire feeds off the republic, the face of imperialism, I called it. $1 trillion a year is spent from the Pentagon budget and related budgets, increasing the deficit into trillions upon trillions. I advocate socialism when it works and because it works. The post office, it works. They're trying to bust up the post office, and they're doing a good job of it now, the Republican Congress is. But it was a very decent kind of thing. It was the largest union workers, a group of union workers in any one, I think, any one enterprise. You could deliver, you still can, deliver for 47 cents, you can deliver a letter from your door to someone 3,000 miles away. For 45 cents, 47 cents, you can do that. Social Security, we've got, and I like that. I think it's fair, it's humane, it's decent. Medicare, when it works, against a prohibitive profit-driven medical and insurance corporations. Public health care for everyone and everything. Housing, transportation, as in France, for instance, or Japan, where they've got these tremendous super monorail trains that go that cannot be derailed. I like that. Public utilities, I find that's better than private utilities. I live in California, and I got PG&E, Pacific Gas and Electric. They talk about private competition and we're efficient and we give you – well, they don't do that at all. They charge us the highest rates in America. If you had a public utility, that public utility doesn't spend millions of dollars on advertising. It doesn't spend millions of dollars on its CEO bosses having to be paid 30, 40, 50 million a year. The public utilities are much, much safer. PG&E got a $45 million handout from the state of California to start checking up on the gas leaks in his whole system of gas, and it didn't do it. It even got, in San Bruno, it got complaints from people who were smelling gas, and it didn't do it. It used that money to wage a proposition campaign, to have a proposition which said that only private utilities can function in California, no public utilities. And they had millions of dollars to spend, and the miracle was that they lost. The people voted against that. The people are interested in socialism as long as you don't call it socialism and you just give them the benefits and the functions of it. And so what PG&E did was they spent all that money on that campaign. They lost the campaign, but in San Bruno there was an explosion, a gas leak, and 8 people were killed and 40 homes were blasted. I saw photographs of it. I treated it in my book, Profit Pathology, a little bit of a chapter on that. And public education is being destroyed, as we see before our own eyes, where students are having to pay for education when they were supposed to get one that was free with minimal costs. Professorships are getting wiped out, and adjuncts are being used. An adjunct is a teacher who gets paid only by a course, one course here, one there, and all that. Very poorly paid, hard to survive. And this is what's happening. And the money goes to the big administrators and goes to the presidents of the universities and the regents and the like. So you turn the university into something that resembles a private corporation. We hear that we must fix the system. Unfair tax distribution, insufficient health care goes on, low wages, wage theft, all sorts of inequities. But no, some of us argue, the system is fixed. It's rigged already. It is the way they want it to work. As far as they're concerned, these last 10 years haven't been so bad. I've had students say, one time when I was teaching at SUNY, State University of New York in Albany, the students said, but what socialism does? How would it work? It's a dream, isn't it? A dream in theory and a nightmare in practice. That's a phrase I myself coined just to sum it up for their anxieties. You think it's a dream in theory and a nightmare in practice. My students at SUNY, they would say, "How would it work?" And I would say, "Well, you're sitting in it right now." You are too, you know, or less and less, of course, as they privatize it. Better than private colleges on Long Island and more affordable before they raise tuition horribly and privatize private education. And so I'm for that. I'm for real public education. I'm for real public utilities, for public housing that's affordable and made in a humane fashion, public transportation, public hospitals. So I advocate socialism because it works when it works. Small business, small services, maybe they could also work and have a place there. End the power of these giant corporations. Bring back real democracy and real prosperity. Thank you for your kind attention, folks.
Michael Parenti, concluding his fine talk, Capitalism versus Reality, very lightly edited by yours truly. Thank you for listening to New World Notes. Find us on the web at newworldnotes.blogspot.com. From Darkest Connecticut, this is Kenneth Doust, advising illegitimate non-carborundum, and please come back again next week. Ciao.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, 9/11 wake up call.
I'm sick and tired of hearing things from uptight, short-sighted, narrow-minded hypocrites. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth. I've had enough of reading things by neurotic, psychotic, pig-headed politicians. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth. No short-head yellow-bellied.
Hello, listeners, and welcome to this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. On Wednesday, December 30th, I heard part of a Where We Live show on NPR, and during part of the show, the guests were talking about conspiracy theorists as if they were all nutcases, and it didn't matter the issue. Several, quote, conspiracies were discussed, 9/11 being one of them, and they referred to conspiracy theorists as, quote, horrible trolls, and said that the facts didn't matter to these horrible trolls. And Colin McEnroe, who was a guest on the show, even made the misinformed statement that the 9/11 Commission report was a complete and thorough report, which even the 9/11 commissioners themselves have said isn't the case. So according to the esteemed guests on this NPR show, the following two former FBI agents that you're about to hear would be, quote, horrible trolls, conspiracy theorists, who just won't accept the facts. The first one is a former FBI agent. He introduces himself well at the beginning of it. So let's hear his take on 9/11.
I'm Ted L. Gunderson, a 27-year veteran of the FBI who retired in March of 1979. At the time of my retirement, I was the senior special agent in charge of the FBI Los Angeles Division with more than 700 personnel under my command and a budget of $22.5 million. I was an agent on the street for 9.5 years, and then I advanced administratively. I was a supervisor, and then I was number two man in Connecticut and Philadelphia, and assistant special agent in charge was the title. And then I became a chief inspector, and then I was agent in charge in Memphis, Dallas, and the senior special agent in charge in Los Angeles, because I had three other special agents in charge under me and 24 supervisors under them. I have information chiseled in stone, documented, that the FBI had advanced knowledge about 9/11 and did nothing to prevent this from occurring. And this is atrocious. It's unbelievable, having been a former FBI agent myself. And it's very obvious that this whole thing has been orchestrated by the powers that be at the highest level of our government. And I want the world to know about it. The minute I saw the planes fly in to the tower on television, live, as a matter of fact, the question I had in my mind was, there is no way, absolutely no way, that somebody could skyjack four planes, 20 people skyjack four planes, in this case 19 individuals, and our government would not know about it in advance. We have, the U.S. government, the most advanced intelligence techniques of anybody in the world, and you'll never convince me we didn't have advanced knowledge about what was going on. We saw the airplanes go in, and it's also a question about whether they're remotely controlled. I don't know about that. I hate to comment on something that where I have no documentation, but there's much more to this story than has come out so far. You will never in a million years convince me that those buildings, those towers, collapsed because those planes hit them. I'm confident that they were imploded. As a matter of fact, there were seismograph readings, they think from the base of two of them, about the time that the buildings collapsed. There were also molten steel that was in the basement, which is a very high temperature for melting steel, and those planes hit above the 80th floor, so there's no way that airplane fuel could have dropped down that low. Also, there were fires that burned in the basement for some 100 days afterwards. So there's some implication, there's some finagling, there's some maneuvering. As far as I'm concerned, and there are many, many more people involved in this than these so-called skyjackers and terrorists. The anti-terrorism legislation was written back in the middle 1980s under the George Bush Sr. administration. A female Department of Justice attorney, who was one of the authors, made the statement publicly, before this passes Congress, people have to be killed. Now, if we fast forward to a World Trade Center car bombing in February 1993, at that time, the FBI had a 43-year-old former Egyptian Army officer as an informant who was in with the terrorists. He was commissioned by the terrorists to put the bomb together. He went to his FBI superiors, we're going to use a dummy bomb, right? And they said, no, we're going to use a real bomb. So the FBI not only knew in advance that they were going to bomb the World Trade Center, they furnished the ingredients for the bomb, which is absolutely unbelievable that they get away with this. What's unbelievable about it is this was actually printed in the New York Times on October 28, 1993. But they got away with it. And if I was a congressman or senator, I would demand an investigation. Why would the FBI furnish the ingredients for the bomb that brought down or that had damaged the World Trade Center in February 1993. We had six people killed there. We had 1,000 people injured. We had a total of six citizens who died in the February 1993 World Trade Center car bombing. We had 1,000 individuals who were injured. We had $500,000 in damage. But there weren't enough people who died to pass the anti-terrorism legislation. So now we fast forward to April the 19th, 1995, Oklahoma City bombing. We had 169 people who died, probably 169 because there was one leg they never did identify. And a year later, the anti-terrorism legislation passed. Now, it wasn't tough enough. I can't prove that there were explosives that were placed in the World Trade Center in the 9-1-1 situation. However, from what I've seen, an expert on implosions from Albuquerque, New Mexico, who worked for the government as under government contract, stated immediately afterwards that the buildings were imploded. And then he retracted his statement and said, well, maybe they were, maybe they weren't. But basically, now he's saying that they weren't imploded. But other experts who have looked at the pictures say that the buildings were imploded. I think that in order to implode those buildings, there had to be implications, government implications or involvement in placing these charges. I mean, that was a tremendous project. I mean, I don't know how many people would be involved in that. Going back to Oklahoma City, an inside investigator told me there were at least 11 other people involved in the Oklahoma City bombing. Now, if you have 11 other people involved in Oklahoma City, you're going to have three or four times that involved in the World Trade Center situation.
So that was former FBI agent Ted Gunderson. To learn more about the Oklahoma City bombing that he mentioned, check out the film A Noble Lie. I think you can get it on YouTube. And yes, there's lots of evidence to support that that was also a staged event and is being covered up. But don't take my word for it. Please do your own research. I was really shocked when I first realized that the Oklahoma City bombing was not what I had been told it was by our government and media. And trust me, you're not going to hear about it on NPR. And now we're going to listen to a former FBI translator, author, journalist, and whistleblower, Sibel Edmonds, talking about who created Al-Qaeda and ISIS. Sibel Edmonds has been gagged by the U.S. government, and she's written a couple of books to get her story out. One is called Classified Woman, and the more recent one is called Gladio B, which I highly recommend. What you're about to hear is from an interview on the show Sophie and Co. on RT, with Sophie Shevardnadze doing the interview. So here it is.
The sweeping wave of the ISIS advance came out of a clear blue sky, with American drones and satellites caught napping. How was it missed by the omnipresent eye of U.S. intelligence? How far will the West now go to combat it? And is the terror onslaught too strong to contain?
Former FBI whistleblower, author Sybil Edmonds is my guest today. Sybil, it's really great to have you on our show. So when asked if the rise of ISIS was a surprise, Obama admitted the intelligence community underestimated ISIS in Syria. Did it not see it coming in Syria or Iraq?
Well, the answer depends on if you want to take President Obama or the U.S. authorities and their words and evaluate based on that. I think where the rise of ISIS is mainly about a brand change. Sometimes as it happens in marketing, we get to see exactly the same principle within the geopolitical games that have been in play for a while now, especially since the end of the Cold War. And the Al-Qaeda brand began wearing off. And that brand now has been changed to ISIS, and as always, by design. And considering the fact that we cultivated and put together and financed and created the ISIS, for me, it goes into one of those caricature or the funny statements that are put out by the mainstream media, statements issued by people like Obama or anybody from the State Department.
So what you're saying basically is it was expected for ISIS to turn into something so powerful, into a powerful group, but they're just not admitting to it.
Well, to answer the question briefly, it is ISIS is what is the U.S. media and the propaganda creators from behind the media decide to create. Tomorrow or 3 months from now, we will start hearing another name that we've never heard of. And within a month, they can make that the world's greatest or the most dangerous threat. And again, that is the main concept here. And I know the mainstream media, U.S. media, the Western media, they have been playing it as such, but they did exactly the same thing with Al-Qaeda. I mean, Al-Qaeda was 100 people or 100,000 people or 10 million people. Another interesting perspective in this is that I refer to the brand change, and sometimes you have to switch the brand for the marketing purposes. And ISIS, as you can look at and see from the term, from the name now, the brand created, the Western powers have gotten closer to just name and link the entire global terrorism to Islam. And that's another marketing strategy by the United States, NATO, and the main Western countries.
What we hear from the media is that President Obama blamed the chaos of the Syrian civil war for the rise of ISIS. At the same time, you have the United States doesn't hide that it's been helping the rebels in Syria from the very beginning. Did U.S. intelligence know who they were funding?
Absolutely, as they did in the 80s with the Mujahideens in Afghanistan, as they did with various so-called Islamic terror cells within Caucasus and Central Asia, as they did with Al-Qaeda. And this is no different. As I said, you're only looking at a brand change. You're not looking at any kind of a new phenomenon as far as the U.S. global perpetual warfare is concerned.
Now, the U.S. is only ramping up support for moderate rebel groups in Syria, or so they say. So who works to determine if rebels are moderate or no? Is there really a way of knowing that?
Again, it is really difficult to talk to or talk around all these propaganda created by the Western powers through the mainstream media. And I feel like if I start even commenting on that, I'm belittling the facts on the ground. And again, I want to go back and provide the context and say, look, Mujahideens, which later became AKA Al-Qaeda's, they were the freedom fighters. And we have had similar situation in the Balkans during the war. You know, you had people that were, or the factions that were considered, you know, fanatics or criminal or terrorists, whether it was KLA, and then they became freedom fighters. They became our allies. And again, you're looking exactly at the same thing, different brand, but you're looking exactly at the same phenomenon. And we can talk around this and bring in all the different characterization put forward by the Western media, and then we can put it and compare it, what has been happening in the past 30, 35 years, And we'll see that the marketing strategy is the same. It's just the brand difference.
What we're seeing right now is that U.S.-led airstrikes in Syria aren't stopping ISIS. Well, at least not yet. And the Kurdish fighters on the ground are asking for ground support. Will the U.S. be sending troops to fight ISIS on the ground? What do you think?
Again, that's going to depend on various factors on what's going to happen. And again, I'm going to go back to context and history. The Kurdish factions and the Kurdish factor has always been used and played. The Kurdish faction and the Kurdish factor was the case when we had the war with Iraq. You know, we had the northern territory and the Kurdish area. Then we always get to, okay, what's going to be Turkey's role? Are they going to be wary of what's going to happen afterwards? If this happens with us and the Kurds, and again, you're looking at the exact, the same replicate of what we had in place, what was taking place during the initial stage of war against Iraq.
Right now, the U.S. military actions in Iraq have one set of objectives, and then in Syria another. For example, Kurds in Iraq received so much aid so quickly from the United States, unlike the Kurds in Syria. What is it, like two kind of brands of Kurds, like you say? Is it wise to assume two different strategies when fighting one enemy?
Absolutely. You have the Kurds in Iran, and you're looking at a totally different characteristics and where they stand within the, there are over 25, 30 million Kurds, okay? And the Kurds in Syria, you have the Kurds in Turkey, you have the Kurds in Iraq, you have the Kurds in Iran. And right now, the game and the play being centered around the stage in Syria. So we are looking at a different mechanism there than when you're looking at what's happening with the northern Iraq. And also you have to look at the oil factor, okay? What do we have in Syria where the Kurds are concentrated versus what we have in northern Iraq, places such as Kirkuk? And, well, do we have the oil factor in play there or we don't have it there? So if you start putting those kinds of information that comes with each region and the different sects versus, let's say, in this case, Kurds, and you're looking at several different factors in play. You're not looking at only one. So you're not looking at Kurdish faction, and here are the Kurds, and trying to basically put them all in the same bucket. It all depends on the geostrategic facts and what you're facing, what we have, what is in play, what is at stake. And then again, you can never compare northern Iraq with what's happening with Syria and the Kurdish region in Syria.
Yeah, because I was thinking maybe they're not helping the Kurds in Syria because they're affiliated with the Kurds in Turkey, and America maybe doesn't want to upset Turkey being one of its greatest allies. No?
No, not really, because you had exactly the same scenario with the Kurds in northern Iraq and the Kurds inside Turkey. And if you look at the border region and the cross-border activities between the Kurds in Iraq and in Kurds in Turkey, we had exactly the same situation. And this was one of the main reasons that Turkey did not want to allow the United States using its air base during the early stage of the war against Iraq. It was about the Kurds in northern Iraq and how that would upset the equilibrium that the Turkish government wants to preserve and keep in place as far as the Kurdish faction is concerned.
Now, the former CIA chief and ex-defense secretary Leon Panetta said the U.S. is looking at least 30-year war against ISIS, which is not at all what the White House is telling the public. Is he exaggerating?
Well, I would say it's a very short period. I'm really surprised because we just talk about the brand change. The war against Al-Qaeda was declared as a forever war, and it has been expanding. I mean, the war against Al-Qaeda started when it was supposed to be in Afghanistan, and we started chasing Al-Qaeda in Yemen and Pakistan with all the drone attacks, Al-Qaeda in Iraq. And the fact that this was going to be a forever war. And now that the brand has changed to ISIS, I'm very surprised that former CIA director is stamping it with such a short time period. I believe 30-year period is very short, unless they have already in plan other sects or the other factions that they are going to declare the world's most dangerous terrorist. I would say it's a very short period of time. We currently are more interested in an ongoing, never-ending perpetual war. So I would say if you compare it with what we have been characterizing or our government and the media, Al-Qaeda, I would say I'm surprised that he has put such a short time stamp on ISIS, considering the attraction or the attractiveness of the brand, because it has the word Islam built into it. And let's just forget Al-Qaeda. I mean, Al-Qaeda was just the noun, you know, the name. And in this case, you're looking at a far-reaching implications when you declare the current greatest threat with an organization that has the word Islam built into it. And I think it's much more attractive to be used. So I would say, yeah, it should be forever. I'm surprised it's 30 years.
Now, U.S. Vice President Joe Biden blamed Saudi Arabia, the United Arab Emirates, and Turkey for helping extremists in Syria. But then he later apologized for his comments. But was he right?
Okay, so rather than dignifying people like Biden, let's talk about, again, context and history. My website, our news organization, was the first one to really break within the United States the training of the Syrian rebels in Turkey. And this was about 6 to 9 months before anything about Syria actually made it into the news. And using U.S. airbase, and this is in southern Turkey, close to the border with the Syria. And this was NATO and the United States factions training and arming and sending them back, having them cross the border, rebels, long before actually it became news, Syria. And again, as I said, this was done in Turkey by the NATO's forces, mainly U.S. and British forces. And it was something that was planned and designed and implemented by the United States. So for Joe Biden to come and right now, you know, putting this out, of course, he will get away with it because the mainstream media here, they're not going to go and revisit the facts that were exposed with the activities of U.S., what they did in Turkey, training these factions. I mean, now it's called ISIS. It's like French fries or the freedom fries. You're looking exactly the same fries at the same price. So that's all I'm going to say. It is just ludicrous. And then he took it back because it upset the current president in Turkey, Erdogan. And I wouldn't even find it really newsworthy, but it's funny.
Why is it more important for Sunni countries like Qatar or Turkey to bring down President Assad than to contain extremism? Because you have Saudis and Qataris helping the anti-Assad rebels and the Turks asking Kurds to turn against Assad before they get any help with ISIS. Why?
In reality, if you're looking at the factual, objective analysis of it, really, it's not to their advantage whatsoever. I mean, you just name the countries. For example, Turkey is a member of NATO, and Turkey is greatly managed and directed by the United States, has been for several decades. There's no question about that. And when you're looking at United Emirates and the countries within the region, you know, including Saudi Arabia, you're looking at the tentacles of the United States. I call them the tentacle nations. So if you start looking at saying, what is their advantage? Of course, there are no advantages, and you only look at disadvantages. If you start polling people within these countries, and I can speak to Turkey, for example, if you start getting the opinion polls in Turkey, you will see that over 90% of people in Turkey are against such moves. And Turkey had a pretty good relationship with Assad and with Syria. You know, they engage in some really good level of commerce, and there has been zero advantage. They have to implement policies created, designed, and issued by the United States, by NATO, and that's what they are doing. So to answer your question, it has never been a question of any other nations, especially in the region, their interests or their advantages or even comparative advantages. It has always been about what is designed, what is put in place, what orders are issued here in the United States. And that's the end of it. And the other people's interest, the other nation's interest, is not even in the equation. It's never been. And if you ask the populace, people in those nations, they would actually nod and they would say, yes, that's exactly what they believe because that's the reality.
All right, here's another possible and interesting turn of events. FBI Chief Mike Comey warned terrorists are working on an effort to attack the United States very, very soon. Is the U.S. ready to respond?
Well, again, we have to look at different things and say why this statement was made. Is it based on some sort of facts and real solid intelligence gathered? Or is it the fact that, for example, we have had for the TSA and for the flights, you know, the threat level has been really low. And when that goes for a long time, people, they get antsy. They say, well, you know, this is really annoying to have all these screens out there and going through them. We haven't had any terrorist threats, really. The level has not been blinking red or even orange. It's been yellow. Let's go through the rainbow colors. So it's time to re-energize the Americans with the fear of terrorism. We need to have more expenditure for things to put in place because we can go ahead and increase the threat level within the airports. Let me give you an example. If you look at the stock market and look at the stock prices for all the military industrial complex related companies and firms, you will see how they have just gone up tremendously since the brand from Al-Qaeda switched to ISIS. And this is, again, the brand change I'm referring to. This is when you say, yes, now we can go ahead and produce and sell more to the government and spend billions more. So the same thing is true for the internal security fear-mongering factors on the ground in the United States. It's time to re-energize that fear, and that's exactly what they are doing. And what's going to follow this is going to be more measures put in place, whether it's within the airports or whether it's the hiring within the FBI or increasing the number of informants. Those are the things that are going to follow this announcement. We have to have more expenditure because of the fear level is going to go up, and therefore those expenditures are going to be justified. And it's as simple as that.
The FBI also says that dozens of Americans are believed to be fighting in Syria with rebel groups. How did that happen?
Well, it has to happen. Even if it's not the case, it has to happen because you're looking at how ordinary Americans perceive these things. Well, think about it. Syria and this area, you know, that region in Iraq, they are thousands of miles away. What can they do to us from there? So it's not enough to raise the terror threat and really do some heavy duty fear mongering. But if you bring some U.S. elements and ties in there, if we have Americans who are there, who are going to come back here and they're going to start be our boogeyman here on the ground and they're going to blow up buildings, that's going to be marketing-wise more attractive. So it's going to be easier to sell to the American public the notion of our war against ISIS. We're not going to hear much of Al-Qaeda for a while. So Al-Qaeda is going to disappear and exit the stage, replaced by ISIS. So yes, that's another marketing strategy. If you start looking at some of what has been happening and what is being put forth by these people, including the former CIA director and the US media, and if you start looking at it from the marketing perspective, we get to find more answers and understand what's going on rather than trying to approach this through some logical, political, philosophical, or even sociological analysis. And I think the best model that fits what's happening right now and explains it is the marketing model. And we should look at it as such.
Twitter is suing the FBI because it is not allowed to tell the public when the government asks for surveillance help. Why is surveilling Twitter such a big deal for U.S. government? So much really depend on Twitter and other social media?
Well, why surveilling all the Americans through NSA with their phone, every single phone conversation is such an important thing for the government? And again, I'm going to take us back and say, what kind of reaction from the public does this create? I mean, when we hear every day of how much is being gathered from the Facebook, it's true, and what's being gathered and collected and how people are being monitored through their Twitters, combined with what we have already known since 2004, 2005, the expose on NSA, you have a better chance of controlling the majority, controlling the people.
Sybil, can the FBI, CIA, NSA control their information, prevent it from gaining public attention? Like, what can prevent people like you, for instance, or Ed Snowden from speaking out?
Nothing. Nothing prevents people from speaking out. I have been speaking out. I don't think the U.S. government is really bothered. If the United States government is really bothered by people who are speaking out, people like myself or some credible real whistleblowers, and if that becomes a real threat, it's very easy for them to take out those people, to eliminate them. But they are not, because it hasn't risen to that level yet. If the reach were such, and if the consequences of people speaking out really reach the real masses and brought out, you know, some reaction, then you will be looking at a totally different scenario or the reaction or action by the U.S. government. But we haven't seen it yet.
And again, that was Sybil Edmonds, author, journalist, and former FBI translator and whistleblower, on the show Sophie and Company on RT. This interview was done before Russia started bombing ISIS at the request of the Syrian government. Are these two former FBI employees really, quote, horrifying trolls, as the NPR pundits have labeled them, because they question the official explanation of events? I think you're smart enough to decide that for yourselves and not have to be labeled, quote, horrifying troll by uninformed talk show hosts at NPR for questioning your government and the controlled media. In fact, these questioning citizens may be the only hope we have of ending the global war on terror and all of the other destructive things happening to our fragile planet and its people, inflicted on us all by the elite for profit and the New World Order. Sibel Edmonds has a radio show and a podcast which can be found at the website BoilingFrogsPost.com. And again, that's BoilingFrogsPost.com. I encourage you to check her website out. She's got a wealth of knowledge about 9/11 and geopolitics. This concludes this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. Thanks for listening.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, building bridges.
Building Bridges with Ken Nash and myself, Mimi Rosenberg. We begin by a terrible feeling I have of trepidation, but I hope that won't be validated by our guests. But January 11th, the U.S. Supreme Court heard oral argument from a conservative legal challenge targeting public sector unions. The justices of the Supreme Court have taken up the case brought by non-union teachers who object to having to pay for collective bargaining rights. The dispute pits 10 public school teachers and the Christian Educators Association International against the California Teachers Association, a union with 325,000 members and a history of backing liberal political causes. Unions that are certified to represent a group of employees are legally compelled to represent all employees in that unit, which means bargaining on behalf of all the workers for health care and other benefits, higher wages, and representing them in grievances to adjudicate their rights against their employers.
The dues pay for unions to be able to advocate for services to its members and to administratively function as an organization. This court challenge seeks a decision that would economically starve the public workers' organizations, affecting their ability to advocate for their members' individual economic benefits and their political rights as workers.
And we are joined now by Carolyn Fredrickson, president of the American Constitution Society for Law and Policy, and Joe Burns, labor lawyer and author of Strike Back, using the militant tactics of labor's past to reignite public sector unionism today. Public sector unionism has been one of the areas of growth, or at least stability, as the private sector unions have been hit hard, and their numbers and the numbers of workers who are represented have diminished significantly. So the right is going fiercely after the public sector unions. But we'll hear much more about that from Carolyn and Joe. But I want to begin by, and ask Carolyn if this is an absolute red herring. So we are told that really what's going on here, this is a question of speech. It's a question of politics. Why should I, if I am in a bargaining unit and don't like the political positions, why should I have to give money to that union? It is, of course, we won't, well, maybe we will talk about what happens in terms of corporations that are people that have all kinds of speech now that nobody seems to inhibit. But so is that a total fraud? Is this nothing?
Well, it is. It okay. is a total fraud. I mean, there are people who don't want to pay for the political activities of the union don't have to. The fees that they pay are very restricted and go only towards the cost of the actual collective bargaining and the administration of the contract that the union is able to win. And so but basically the theory behind it is, as you articulated so well earlier, is that a free rider issue is a big one. When workers are getting the benefits of what the union has done, which is get them higher wages and get them better benefits, that they should have to pay at least for the cost of maintaining that. They have no responsibility and can easily opt out of any of the political activities of the union. And as I said, it's very narrowly constrained what is even considered what they call chargeable by the union. That is, what can actually go towards these fair share fees and what has to be an additional requirement that the worker be a union member to support any other activity besides those. So the fact that these opponents of workers are raising this when it's clearly not in the case is just another way of really trying to cover up what's going on here, which is destroying one of the sole mechanisms that workers have now, which is to get together collectively and fight for a fair wage and fair benefits.
And Joe, paradoxically, it's the conservatives that are putting forth this, quote, free speech, end quote, argument. The liberals are talking about the free rider aspect of it, that the union has to represent all of the workers in the bargaining unit. You want to talk about that, and also maybe about Scalia, who seems to have turned on this issue?
Yeah, so basically in many states and in right-to-work states under federal law as well, the union is the exclusive representative of the group of workers. And as such, has legal obligations to represent those workers. So all of the workers are represented in collective bargaining. And in particular, if a worker gets disciplined, even if they're not a union member, the union has an obligation to have trained stewards who are going to represent that worker, take the case to arbitration if it has merit, which can involve thousands of dollars, union lawyers, and so forth. So there's a lot of financial obligations that the union has in terms of representing these workers. And what the law had been before, well settled, is that the union can, if someone opts out of being a member, they can't charge them for the blatantly political, you know, like campaigns and so forth, but for these core collective bargaining issues, they can charge them. Otherwise, these people are free riders and basically have an incentive to take the benefit and not pay for it. So that's kind of one component of it. And the other one that doesn't get talked about is as much is that, the workers and unions, you know, traditionally have taken the decision that it should be a democratic decision. And if you vote to have a union in, then, you know, everyone should, go along with the decision. Employers, in contrast, want to treat workers as a collection of individuals. And don't really want to respect us as a union or as a group and the decisions that the workers make together. And by allowing, you know, a minority to opt out of the – or not even opt out, have to support the union when the majority has voted for it, it really weakens the union and the union's ability to make gains and to, you know, have a premium which has existed in the public sector.
Sure. Well, I mean, I think people have to realize that the right has taken the First Amendment, which I think most of us in the progressive world think is obviously a very good and important part of our Constitution, the right to free speech, but they have turned it on its head. And now the right to free speech is a right to bury opponents in money. If I'm richer than you, my voice is going to be that much stronger than yours. And that is where we've come from, you know, the whole set of cases involving Citizens United. So the First Amendment has become a sword in favor of reducing democracy in terms of reducing the ability to have a fair election, and now is becoming a sword to take down a vehicle for worker collective action. And let me just say we should talk a little bit about the sort of the history of this fair share fees. This is a very long-standing arrangement that the Supreme Court has approved for almost 40 years. Justice Scalia himself is on the record of upholding it in other cases. It's a commonsensical arrangement that the employers want. And so the issue of free speech here is a very minor one, ultimately, and the court has recognized in many other contexts that in the world of where when the employer and the government are the same, you don't have the same rights in terms of free speech versus the government if it's your boss than you do if you're just a citizen, which makes sense, right? Because any employer has to have some ability to have some control over the workplace. That's normal. But what they're saying is that somehow the free speech argument is going to trump anything else that the government might want in terms of how it regulates its workforce.
Joe Burns, give us some context and background for this a carefully orchestrated attack. After all, this is settled law. I mean, once again, the Supreme Court is deciding to reconsider settled law. So what's really behind this? Give us some of that background.
Yeah, so, I mean, obviously the words of the Constitution haven't changed, so what has changed? You know, the political context has changed, the power of public employee unions has changed, and really created an opening for this attack. And I think it's important to see this not as a standalone constitutional issue, but really part of a political attack against public employee unions, which has been going on for quite a while, but, you know, in particular, the last, 8-10 years, it's really intensified. So this is part of the same process that saw, the Wisconsin Uprising was fighting against with Governor Scott Walker, what we saw in Michigan and, you know, other states, Indiana and so forth, and what's currently going on in Illinois with the battle that public employees are having with the Republican governor there. And it's really part of this idea that public employee unionism is illegitimate, and that's a battle that public workers fought and won 50 years ago when the courts had these a lot of the same notions that public employee unionism was somehow suspect. So when I was reading through the transcript today and listening to some of the questions from the Supreme Court justices, it really sounded like arguments that were made, 60, 80 years ago, in the 1950s and so forth, where, you know, they view any bargaining, any sort of activity by public workers, in terms of bettering their working conditions as somehow political and taking away power from the government and the politicians. And that's not a framework that public employees accepted in the 1960s and 70s.
Carolyn, I guess the only drama today was the question of which way Scalia would fall on this, because in the past he's taken the position that the free riders need to pay a fee because they're covered by the contract. Is everything came down fairly predictable as far as you're concerned in terms of the
justices? I think people were hopeful that he would be consistent on this position, that the fair share fees are appropriate arrangement. He certainly didn't seem like that today, but I would caution the listeners from assuming too much from an oral argument. And that may be partly because I'm an optimist, but you really often don't know. Sometimes the justices really want to kind of get all of the toughest questions on the table. They want to be a contrarian. And so, you know, and then there's a lot of work that goes on behind the scenes in terms of the members talking to each other, I mean, the justices talking to each other, and, you know, they do some amount of dealing on how the decisions come out. And so, you know, he definitely was didn't seem very sympathetic today, which would be, you know, a reversal of where he's been in the past. But I guess I'm not ready to take that for a final answer.
Well, maybe if I can just push it a little, I'm more interested in what happened with Kennedy, who we have grown to see as more, quote, liberal, I use the word very advisedly, and of course this is the Roberts Court, and this has been a business-friendly court, and the Supreme Court now has a majority of its members who make their way to the court with corporate-funded conservative backing. So really, how are we to understand, aside from the specifics of this case, really what's happening with the court using this vehicle of worker organizations to support really the working class?
Yeah, I think Justice Kennedy was never one that people had a great deal of hope for, honestly. He may be liberal on issues around LGBT rights, or at least he's not hostile as some of the others are, but I don't think he's ever been much of a safe vote on issues around workers' rights. And so I don't think this is a terrible surprise that he also seems somewhat hostile today. It's just not an area where he's been very friendly.
Yeah, and I think it's important, you know, in terms of how you view the Supreme Court, if you view them as just some dispassionate individuals even-handedly in isolation interpreting the law, which I don't believe is correct, or whether you view them as part of an overall political process. And what's going on in this country right now is there is a concerted attack on public employee bargaining rights. They're trying to turn back the law, 50, 60 years. And, you know, they exist in this context. And if you look at the question of, in particular, union dues, conservative writers, really started focusing on this a number of years ago, like Fox News contributors writing books and so forth, about the problem that they saw with unions having money and they wanted to cripple them. So, I think it all exists in a context, and, I would not be too hopeful about the outcome of this case, based on, just the trajectory of things, plus the specifics of the oral argument today. And I think there's also a concern about, where will they head from here? Because you can look down the road and, the logical extension of this, if they rule against agency fee here is then they'll start looking at the private sector and want to impose right to work upon the private sector as well. These conservatives are, they're relentless in their attack on union rights.
Yeah, I think the problem that really is a category failure on the part of, and purposefully perhaps, as I think was well articulated, that this may well just be part of a political agenda, but what the conservatives focused on was the idea that anything that happens in the public employment context is inherently political, and therefore everything is free speech. And that means that the free speech argument becomes much, much stronger than the way it had been approached in the past, which was to say, You know, as I mentioned earlier, that the free speech rights of public employees are actually somewhat limited for all sorts of reasons, and that has been recognized in other contexts about what control the government can have over its workforce. And in that context, they have recognized that the government, if it favors this arrangement, can certainly prefer to bargain with one entity rather than have to have a, you know, every single employee deal with each of them on their own grievances and wages and all of that. And so the issue really, you know, that the conservatives focused on was how anytime there's any issue, whether wages now are not just an issue that are concerning of the workers, but are a public issue because, you know, taxes might get raised or government resources are being used. And so they took it really out of the context in which it had been handled in the past and turned it into a discussion of how, you know, that the inherent political nature of everything that happens in the public employment context, which really stacks the deck against the workers, even though on first blush, and this is why it's such a clever argument, it might actually seem like it was pro-worker, right? Because you're saying, oh, it's their First Amendment rights. And in fact, what you're doing is allowing this small group of Koch brothers-funded individuals who are put forward and were hand-selected by these conservative activist groups to take away the rights of the vast majority of employees in order to advance this radical agenda that doesn't allow employees to actually bargain for their rights.
Joe, Justice Roberts said that the issue of free riders is insignificant, while Kagan has said that even union supporters would have a economic incentive to quit the union so that they could not pay dues. How detrimental would this be to unions, public sector unions, if this is upheld?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think what we've seen is that, you know, in states that, you know, they've changed the bargaining laws, we've seen, you know, some pretty good drops in union membership. Now, some of them, as in Wisconsin, were tied in with other initiatives, which also limited the union's ability to bargain over certain subjects and so forth. So, but I think, you know, I mean, I think, you know, the thought process behind this attack and the likely outcome will be a, you know, a drop in union membership. I think it's also important to remember that, you know, the agency shop and the, you know, dues collection is not what made unions powerful. They won that as part of an overall process of winning the right to strike and public employee unionism. So, you know, so in a sense, you know, this is really a symptom rather than the cause of labor's decline.
Carolyn, you mentioned the Koch brothers before. I didn't know if that was a kind of a metaphor for what they do in so many conservative causes, or is that the basis?
It's the reality. Yeah.
Could you tell us a little bit about the funding of this litigation?
Sure. Well, the Center for Individual Rights was is the main instigator of this, but behind them are the various individuals and entities that, you know, we've heard of as that fund, you know, they've funded the anti-affirmative action cases. They've funded the voting, the cases that have helped cripple the Voting Rights Act. And there's the Center for Individual Rights, which has been affiliated with and supported by the Koch brothers, the Bradley Foundation, the Olin Foundation, the Skype Foundation, and others, and it is really is part of an agenda that is about crippling the ability to provide the American people with any sort of social safety net, and that's what this goes after. And you know, this is the piece that goes after the public employees, because I would just say the public employment context is one that where women and workers of color have done better than any other sector in our economy. They have narrowed the wage gap. They have gotten better benefits. It's the sector that's most likely to have paid sick leave and vacation time and other benefits. And so, you know, it's an example that I think so many of us have been proud of where there have been successes. And much of that is due to the fact that the unions have been there and have bargained for better treatment of women and minorities and have erased the discrepancies between different categories of jobs. And so, you know, it's a target. It's been a target for the right. One of our successes is always going to be something that they're going to want to bring down, and that is what they're all about. So that's why these foundations, in particular, and the Koch brothers, are behind this, because this is such an important part of the progressive landscape.
Joe, you had mentioned that there have been periods of times when the public sector unions and other unions can make great strides, even if the law is against them. Do you want to give us a hint of what you're talking about there?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of the ideas that came through from the Supreme Court were these discredited ideas from, you know, from the period leading up until the 1960s, where courts and judges and politicians deemed that public employee bargaining was somehow illegitimate for many of the reasons that that came out in the Supreme Court questions, that it was taking away power from the government, that it was illegitimate, that it was that public workers should not have collective bargaining. So, you know, collective bargaining rights were very few, and striking was outlawed in every jurisdiction of the country going into the 1960s. But public employees developed a conception of their own. And they viewed themselves as having equal rights with private sector workers, and that they should have the right to strike and collect a bargain. And what they did in state after state is engaged in this great upsurge of illegal strike activity. And through that, they won their unions, they won their contracts, but they also forced politicians and judges to change the law to allow for collective bargaining, to allow for the agency shop and so forth. And that's really how that was won, was through activism in the streets. So in many ways, you know, that'll have to be the future of public employee unions if these attacks continue.
And in the last 30 seconds, Carolyn, can you find some silver lining, or just for a way for us to persevere if some of the ominous signs do come true and we wind up with a negative holding from the Supreme Court on this very, very important case about the future of financing, certainly, public sector unions?
Well, that's a hard question, because I think it's just would be a terrible outcome. But let me just say that the one positive note that I've heard from people within the unions is that they're really getting back to basics in terms of making sure that they're doing the best possible internal organizing. But I think, as we've all recognized, you know, human nature is what it is, and if you can get something for free, you're likely to do that. So they're going to try and put their nose to the grindstone and make sure their own members are as enthusiastic and informed about the benefits of union membership, and try and keep them involved and keep them as paying members. But, you know, as I said, that's going to be a harder lift in the new environment. But that's what we're going to work for. And if not, then I think, you know, perhaps they're going to take it to the streets, as my colleague here on the air has mentioned.
Well, thank you, Carolyn Fredrickson, president of the American Constitution Society for Law and Policy, and Joe Burns, labor lawyer and author, and encourage people to do read Strike Back, Using the Militant Tactics of Labor's Past to Reignite Public Sector Unionism Today. We need it more than ever. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you so much.
Right. Thank
you.
Great
being on.
This has been Building Bridges, your community and labor report with Mimi Rosenberg
and Ken Nash. And log on to our website at www.buildingbridgesradio.org.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical. Your online antidote to corporate media crap. Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next,
This Way Out.
The book tells the political story of what were the predominant issues in the mid-70s and early 70s, particularly in the gay liberation and lesbian movement and the New Left. I actually came out in the convent. That's why I say subconsciously I wanted to be in a world of women. Activism is important and critical for all ages. Activism should be part of, I think, everyone's life.
Welcome to This Way Out, the international LGBT radio magazine. I'm Greg Gordon. Marriage equality marches into a Chinese court, Guyana's president opens the door to liberation, and we celebrate outlaw Jean Cordova's lesbian feminist legacy. Those stories and more this week because you've discovered This Way Out.
I'm Michelle Marie Gilkison.
And I'm Tanya Kane Perry.
With News Wrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting LGBT communities around the world for the week ending January 9th, 2016. A court in the world's most populous country has agreed to hear a gay man's historic marriage equality lawsuit. 26-year-old Sun Wen Lin, apparently a pseudonym, sued a civil affairs bureau in China's Hunan province in December for rejecting the marriage application he and his unnamed 36-year-old boyfriend submitted on their one-year anniversary together last June. Sun announced that he received notification on January 5th from Furong District Court that his case had been accepted. It's believed to be the first ever civil marriage equality lawsuit in the communist nation. Sun is arguing that China's marriage law refers to a husband and a wife without specifying gender. He told Reuters that our marriage law says there is the freedom to marry and gender equality, and that those specified rights include civil marriage equality for same-gender couples. Maya Wang, a China researcher at New York-based group Human Rights Watch, told Reuters that courts often reject politically sensitive cases in China, so the fact that the lawsuit is accepted signals some official willingness to address discrimination against LGBT people, which is encouraging. She said that if Sun actually wins his case, it will be a truly watershed moment for LGBT rights in China. Sun's lawyer said the case would be heard within 6 months.
We've got updates to three stories from Africa that we reported last week. 11 people arrested in Senegal on Christmas Eve and charged with homosexuality have been released after a prosecutor told the court that there was insufficient evidence to pursue the matter. The mass arrests occurred at what was described as a gay wedding celebration at a high school in a town outside the capital of Dakar. Local reports suggested that angry crowds wanted to execute the men. One witness told Agence France-Presse that police needed tear gas to disperse one wannabe lynch mob. The men reportedly appeared in court with concealed faces. Consensual adult gay sex is punishable in Senegal by up to 5 years in prison. During an October interview with a French television channel, the West African nation's President Macky Sall said he was opposed to repealing that law.
Six students in Tunisia sentenced last month to 3 years in prison on charges of homosexuality, the harshest possible punishment, are free on bail after an appeals court ordered a new trial. They were each reportedly subjected to anal probes to confirm their homosexuality, a practice condemned by most professional medical associations as useless at best and as torture by several human rights groups. Human Rights Watch called it a grave case of infringement on people's private lives and physical integrity. The students are due back in court in late February. These and similar arrests for private consensual adult gay sex in recent months have provoked a growing call for the repeal of Article 230 of the Penal Code that makes those acts illegal.
But Tunisia's government has shut down the first organization to publicly defend LGBT rights in the northernmost country in Africa. Shums, Sun in Arabic, has been lobbying for repeal of Article 230 since the group was formed last year. A lawyer and spokesman for the NGO said Shums received the one-month suspension notice from the government for non-compliance with the law, but that no other details were provided. He said the group is preparing a legal challenge to the suspension.
Malawi's opposition People's Power Party spokesman Ken Msonda strongly condemned the government's recent release after an international outcry of two gay men arrested for homosexuality in December. Malawi's justice minister had stepped in to quash the case and issued an ordinance to stop enforcement of the anti-gay law in the Southeast African nation. Writing on his Facebook page, Msonda said that, "Arresting them won't address this problem because sooner or later they are being released on bail. The best way to deal with this problem is to kill them. It is pathetic to see our media houses parading these dogs on TV and newspapers hiding behind human rights. Human rights, my foot. The devil has no rights." While several online commentators supported Msonda, the Malawi Law Society condemned his homophobic statements and hate speech. A media statement from the umbrella group representing all attorneys in the country said such speech is not protected by the Constitution. It is, in fact, criminal.
Malawi President Peter Mutharika has joined the conversation, telling a local radio station this week that he wants gay rights protected. His press secretary, Gerald Viola, told BuzzFeed News that these people are human beings and that the president was concerned about reports that LGBT people have been beaten and locked up.
But saying in a television interview that Fiji does not need that rubbish, Fiji's Prime Minister Frank Bainimarama said that marriage equality in the Pacific Island nation will never happen in his lifetime. He said if same-gender couples want to marry, they should go and have it done in Iceland and stay and live there. He was responding to calls by Shamima Ali of the Fiji Women's Crisis Center to open civil marriage to lesbian and gay couples. She called Bainimarama's comments extreme homophobia and said they demonstrate total disrespect for a community in Fiji. The advocate's Daniel Reynolds noted that Fiji only decriminalized same-gender sex in 2010, the same year that Iceland enacted marriage equality.
In encouraging news from South America, Guyana President David Granger responded to growing calls for the repeal of his country's laws banning consensual adult same-gender sex during his weekly television show, The Public Interest, by saying that, "I am prepared to respect the rights of any adult to indulge in any practice which is not harmful to others." Guyana is the only country on the continent where homosexual acts are still illegal. Gross indecency and buggery are punishable by up to a life in prison. The current coalition government pledged during the last election campaign to add sexual orientation and gender identity to the Prevention of Discrimination Act 1997 and the Guyana Constitution, and to repeal laws criminalizing cross-dressing and same-gender intimacy.
In other news, the Human Rights Commission of the U.S. state of Washington enacted a policy in late December that allows trans people to use restrooms, showers, and locker rooms corresponding with their gender identity in all buildings open to the public, including schools. Officials in New York City announced the nation's toughest laws on anti-trans discrimination also in late December. For example, violators who repeatedly refer to a transgender woman as him or Mr. can be fined up to $250,000. Social conservatives, still stinging from the Supreme Court's June marriage equality ruling, have turned their attention to so-called bathroom bills that require trans people to use public facilities corresponding to their birth gender. Using tried-and-true but unfounded scare tactics, proponents claim that allowing trans people to use the facilities matching their gender identity would permit male sexual predators to go into women's locker rooms and bathrooms.
LGBT rights have advanced in the U.S. state of Oklahoma. In late December, Norman became the first city in the Sooner State to ban bias based on both sexual orientation and gender identity in employment, housing, and public spaces. The City Council voted unanimously on December 22nd to add LGBT people to the categories protected by the city's existing human rights ordinance. Norman is a college town, home to the University of Oklahoma, and such areas are often more progressive than other parts of their generally more conservative states. Cindy Rosenthal, the city's first ever popularly elected woman mayor, applauded the council action.
This city council is lending a leadership voice within the state of Oklahoma on matters of human dignity, social justice, and equality.
And the city council of the state capital, Oklahoma City, passed limited anti-bias protections for LGBT people on January 5th. While the hotly debated ordinance only covers housing, it was barely approved by a narrow 5-4 vote. It makes it illegal to deny rental housing, prevent the sale of a house, or refuse to build a home in Oklahoma City based on a person's sexual orientation or gender identity. Mayor Mick Cornett said his tie-breaking vote was an easy decision.
We want everyone to feel welcome in Oklahoma City, and sometimes you have to take steps like this to kind of show that you're an open-minded community.
And finally, the Washington Blade reported that wedding bells have rung for the Reverend Mpho Tutu, the lesbian daughter of Anglican Archbishop Emeritus, renowned LGBT rights advocate, and Nobel Peace Prize laureate Desmond Tutu. The younger Tutu married medical school professor Marceline van Firth in a private civil ceremony in the Netherlands in late December. Mpho, an Anglican priest like her father, is the executive director of Cape Town's Desmond and Leah Tutu Legacy Foundation. Firth is a professor in pediatric infectious diseases at Vrije University in Amsterdam and holds the Desmond Tutu Chair in Medicine. The elder Tutu is best known for his anti-apartheid activism in South Africa, but has been a tireless advocate for LGBT equality for almost as long. He famously said in 2013 that he would refuse to go to a homophobic heaven and that he could not worship a god who is homophobic. The younger Tutu and her new bride plan to hold another marriage ceremony later this year in Cape Town. She recently presided over her parents' renewed vows on the occasion of their 60th wedding anniversary.
That's News Wrap for the week ending January 9th, 2016. Produced by Steve Pride, written by Greg Gordon, and recorded at the studios of KPFK Los Angeles.
Follow the news in your area and around the world. An informed community is a strong community.
News Wrap from This Way Out is brought to you by you.
Help keep us on the air and in your ears at thiswayout.org, where you can also read the text of this newscast. For This Way Out, I'm Tanya Kane Perry.
And I'm Michelle Marie Gilkison.
Due to breaking news, part two of Pride on Screen 2015 will be heard next week. Tune in for Steve Pride's interview with film icon Tab Hunter.
They say we have to tab you something, so that's how Tab came about.
That's next time on This Way Out. And now with some sad news just coming out of Los Angeles, here's our associate producer, Lucia Chappell.
Hours before a world-famous bisexual star man blasted into the heavens, a pioneering lesbian Latina activist and author passed away quietly of brain cancer on January 10th. To friends responding to her death, Jean Cordova was a force of nature, a guard at the gate of hatred, and one of the first true citizens of the lesbian nation. Cordova wrote an open letter to the community she loved announcing her coming end last September. In it, she said, "It is wonderful to have had a life's cause, freedom and dignity for lesbians. I believe that's what lesbian feminism is really about, sharing. We built a movement by telling each other our lives and thoughts about the way life should be. We cut against the grain and rethought almost everything, with just enough left undone for our daughters to reinvent themselves." Cordova supplied some of the means for our daughters to reinvent themselves by bequeathing $2 million to the Estrella Lesbian Foundation for Justice. She is survived by her spouse of 25 years, Lynn Ballin, her siblings of choice, and countless women she inspired, mentored, and organized for decades. Her many exploits were recounted in an interview with Steve Pride on the publication of her 2012 memoir, When We Were Outlaws.
Born at the dawn of the baby boom generation,
Jean Cordova has always been ahead of her time in catching the next wave of social change.
I'm Jean Cordova, author, activist of some 40 years. My first book was when I was a Free Press columnist. It was called Sexism, It's a Nasty Affair, collection of essays about the early days of women's liberation. And then the second book was a memoir about my years in the convent. It was called Kicking the Habit. The latest book is When We Were Outlaws, A Memoir of Love and Revolution. And it covers a period of time between 1974 and 1977. Those 3 years, I was an investigative reporter for the Free Press, the LA Free Press, which was the predecessor of the LA Weekly, but far more radical. I was also the publisher of The Lesbian Tide, which was a national feminist lesbian magazine. In this memoir, I backtracked to several big things that happened in 71 and 73, and it's about the politics of the time. As a Free Press reporter, I interviewed Angela Davis and Emily Harris of the Symbionese Liberation Army and a number of people. I was always off in the field. And so the book tells the political story of what were the predominant issues in the mid-70s and early 70s, particularly in the gay liberation and lesbian movement and the New Left.
For Jean, the road to coming out was not only rough, but it took a detour through a nunnery.
My parents were pretty darn bigoted and very Catholic. So it was sort of natural that I go into a convent, being raised in a very Catholic home. But I thought I was very much in love with God and Mary and all that. And I probably was. And subconsciously, I really wanted to avoid marriage. And that was the only alternative that seemed to be there. This was before women started working in careers.
At that point, Jean was still in the dark about her sexuality.
Being in a strong Catholic family, I didn't even hear the word. So I didn't know. I actually came out in the convent. That's why I say subconsciously I wanted to be in a world of women.
After she accepted she was a lesbian, Jean left the convent and really began her journey.
I remembered from high school that gay-looking women were on softball teams. So I joined a softball team. But after a couple of years, I got very bored, and I was in college, and on the team, they called me the college kid, the one going to UCLA. And it just wasn't enough for me. So I got really lonely, and I was saying, aren't there any political or literary lesbians? There must be some somewhere in the world, because I was very immersed in social work and working in Watts. And so when I found the DOB quite accidentally, and I walked down those basement steps, it was in the bottom of a church, I remember seeing, oh, here are organized women sitting around talking about homosexuality, and they're talking about the government, and they're talking about someday not living this way in a basement. And I was thrilled. I just bought the whole package, and I thought, that's where I need to be, and I stayed.
The DOB, or Daughters of Bilitis, was the first lesbian rights organization in the United States, and in the early 1970s, Jean Cordova became involved with a number of LA's early gay and lesbian organizations.
In the beginning, there was nothing, sort of like Genesis. Then I met Morris Kite and a handful of Gay Liberation Front men, one woman, and I had just found the Daughters. I was president of the LA branch, and we kind of fell into talking with each other. The Women's Center, Feminism, had just come to L.A. in 1970 also. So as far as L.A., both the gay movement and the women's movement were kind of born at the same time in L.A. They started at different times in New York, the women's movement in 66 and the gays in 69. But by the time we got it out here, I was a lesbian feminist by then. I left DOB. And we start talking. Morris Kite, he was like 50 years old, which seemed to us 20-year-olds as ancient. And he said, and even the women's movement said, what about building a counterculture? What about making things, organizations? We didn't think about institutions because that was too establishment. But we said, why don't we make places so we can go and all gays can go to these places? And we won't have to live in the straight world. We can live in a world of women or a world of queers. So Morris began making up organizations. And a couple years later, I began also. And like he started the Gay Community Services Center, which is still over there now, and Christopher Street West, the Gay Pride Organization, and Stonewall Democratic Club. And that's just the mid-70s. Those were his babies, and I joined him in a lot of them. Then I started making my own babies, and I guess the first one was the Lesbian Tide magazine. She was my first and eldest child. It started really small, like a DOB newsletter, but it grew into a national voice, and people began asking for it in college towns. That was the interesting thing. I began to notice we'd have, you know, like 25 subscribers from Ann Arbor, Michigan, and then 20 subscribers from Durham, South Carolina. And after a while, it occurred to me, these are all the college towns. And the paper grew and grew, and it became one of the two largest during that decade.
This is Steve Pride, and we're talking to author-activist Jean Cordova.
In 74, I started working as a journalist at the FREEP, at the L.A. Free Press. I came aboard as a columnist because I was a Chicana and a feminist and a dyke. And Art Kunkin, the publisher, thought, oh, that covers three of my bases, you know. But then I morphed into being a human rights editor and an investigative reporter. Luckily, the later publisher, Penny Grenoble, had a lot of faith in me. And so she sent me to interview some really famous people. And it was in the 70s when the SLA, Sudanese Liberation Army, kidnapped Patty Hearst. The summer of 75, and everybody was looking for her. And I was more interested in Patty Hearst's sidekick, Emily Harris, because I think Patty was just a bourgeois lady who happened to get kidnapped because of who her father was. But Emily Harris and Bill Harris, I wanted to know what turned college kids my own age, we were all the same age, like 25, 26 years old, into a revolutionary struggle that included picking up guns. I thought I was in revolutionary struggle and studying Marxism and doing my bit, but I was wondering whether or not I would go into armed struggle. Would I pick up a gun to defend or to further my beliefs? Would I blow up something?
Another of her FREEP interviews was with controversial Black Panther anarchist Angela Davis, who Jean suspected was hiding something.
When I met and interviewed Angela Davis, she seemed so obviously, this was 74, she seemed to me so butch and so lesbian. And so I really tried to get her to come out as gay, but she wasn't buying it then.
Becoming well known for her hard-hitting interviews with Emily Harris and Angela Davis led to not only a fanatic following for her column, but an occasional actual fanatic.
So every week, it seemed, people then would start calling up and asking for Cordova. That's how I met my Nazi. He was the local captain of the Almani Nazi Party, only he was more into armed struggle. So he had placed a couple bombs. And then toward the end of my interviews, he gets killed, and then the FBI comes chasing me into the Free Press office. So I had some pretty wild adventures. And I also learned a lot politically from all those people.
And Jean was there for the start of the Los Angeles Gay and Lesbian Center. Now a major institution with a $40 million annual budget, its origins were grassroots and its birth difficult.
It was mostly Don Kilhefner and Morris Kide and John Platania. And their original motivation was to get these street kids coming out of the Midwest who are committing suicide and running away from home. Back then, there was a lot more running away from home and I think less suicide. That's the way it seemed at the time. So Morris and Don wanted to collect all these kids and give them food and jobs and a bed overnight and help them get started in life. And so that was the dawn of Gay as Social Service Center. But we really needed it back then. There were just hundreds or thousands coming out to their families and then being thrown out.
So I think that motivation was probably good. It was odd for me to see my mentor, who was an activist, begin to turn into a social services social worker. And I struggled with that and didn't agree with it. And then in terms of people of color or women, the early center, these guys were not very open and didn't understand lesbians at all. And people of color were nowhere to be seen in the early days.
And in the summer of 1975, those differences became too much, and it almost brought an end to the fledgling L.A. Gay and Lesbian Center.
What happened is the government gave the center $939,000, almost $1 million, in 1974 for the Alcoholism Center for Women. So 3-year grant, so $300,000 a year. So the center went out and hired, they had to hire women to run the alcoholism program for women, which still exists today. It's called the Alcoholism Center for Women on Alvarado. So they went out and hired a bunch of us, but they didn't realize that we were feminist. We were gay women, but we had also become feminists. And when we got to GCSC, which was the gay center, it was extremely male-dominated, and there was no way to work yourself up into any administrative posts. There were no lesbians. There's one lesbian on the board of directors, none in management. And so the strike was protesting those things. And it was the time when the center male board could have opened up their arms and welcomed feminist lesbians. And that was the challenge. They could have. But they didn't. They didn't want feminists. They didn't want anything that looked like it was collective or consensus. They wanted to own it, and they did own it. And the strike was about their ownership on the handful of people versus allowing feminism to come and be part of the center. The women's movement was very young, and it was the gay movement's opportunity to accept feminism, now, even among the men. I mean, nothing wrong with men becoming feminists. And I kind of thought my mentor, Morris Kite, was, I guess because he was so politically advanced in so many ways, like racism and stuff, that I thought he would naturally be a feminist. But they turned us down repeatedly. They fired 16 of their employees that day in May. Most of us lesbian feminists, and that's what caused the great strike. We went out and protested. They denied us unemployment, and it's really a story of the women's movement and the gay movement, the beginnings, and them clashing, the first major clash in L.A. of those two movements.
Jean went on to start the first Gay and Lesbian Yellow Pages, and at an age when others retire, is still an active LGBTIQ organizer. So what advice does she have for the new generation of activists?
That activism is important and critical for all ages, whether it's Occupy Wall Street Now, which I love, or some other movement in 5 years, that activism should be part of, I think, everyone's life, that it's very enhancing. You meet people, you learn about issues, you stay current. And the second thing, I think, is that trying to keep a balance in your life between your work and your relationship is a struggle for activists and others.
This has been a conversation with Jean Cordova. Her new book is called When We Were Outlaws, A Memoir of Love and Revolution. For more information, visit her at jeancordova.com. This is Steve Pride. Thanks for listening.
Jean, the roses are red, and all the leaves have gone green.
Jean Cordova died on January 10th at the age of 67. Thanks for choosing This Way Out, the international LGBT radio magazine. This week, Michelle Marie Gilkison, Tanya Kane Perry, and Steve Pride contributed program material, and Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. This Way Out thanks the Yavanna Foundation, the estate of Christopher David Trentum, our contributing affiliate stations, and you, our listener supporters, for making this program possible. Email tworadio@aol.com or write to us at P.O. Box 1065, Los Angeles, California, 90078, USA. For Associate Producer Alicia Chappelle and everyone at This Way Out, I'm Greg Gordon. We thank you for listening online at thiswayout.org and on CHSR Fredericton, New Brunswick, KUOI Moscow, Idaho, WLUW Chicago, Illinois, and more than 200 other stations around the world, including this community radio station. Stay tuned.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap.
Today on Against the Grain, what happened in Cuba after 1959 wasn't only Fidel Castro and the political maneuverings of a revolutionary government, it was also a transformation in culture and cultural production. I'm C.S. Rebecca Gordon Nesbitt discusses her new book, To Defend the Revolution is to Defend Culture, the Cultural Policy of the Cuban Revolution, coming right up. And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. When a society goes through a revolutionary transformation, it's usually described in political terms, how the composition or form of government changes, what happens to the political power of different groups within society. What gets much less attention is culture, as in art, music, film, literature, and other creative and intellectual endeavors and achievements. The question for today is, what did the Cuban Revolution do to culture in Cuba? How was cultural work harnessed to the project of building a new society? And if culture is viewed and treated in certain ways in capitalist nations, how has culture in Cuba after Fidel Castro and his comrades took power in 1959, how has culture in Cuba differed? In what ways was it, and is it, distinctive and perhaps revolutionary in its own right? In her new book, Rebecca Gordon Nesbitt writes that the ambition to eradicate the gap between art and society has been realized to a great extent in Cuba. Rebecca Gordon Nesbitt is founder of and researcher at the Center for Cultural Change in Kent in the UK, and her book is called To Defend the Revolution is to Defend Culture, the Cultural Policy of the Cuban Revolution. When Rebecca joined me in studio, I began by asking her about the social and economic conditions in Cuba in the 1950s, that is, in the decade before the revolution.
Well, as many listeners will know, Cuba had been taken by force by General Fulgencio Batista in 1952, and he had previously served as elected president of Cuba, but when he came back, he enacted a much more militaristic regime. And he was aided and abetted by the United States in upholding this regime. And he concentrated the resources amongst a very small elite within Havana. So education, culture, and material resources were all reserved for this tiny elite minority. So although there were fairly good indicators if you took the literacy or the health of the population as a whole, when you started to break it down, it was very clear that great inequalities existed between urban and rural areas and also within urban areas, particularly in Havana. And beyond that, if we're thinking about the culture of the revolution, many artists were excluded from participating in this elite situation and were denied access to the resources to make their work and distribute their work. And artists were getting fairly disgruntled by all of this. So at the time of the insurrection, which began in 1953, artists were already starting to think about how they might bridge the gap between themselves and the wider population because they weren't happy with this kind of elite situation.
What links were made between culture and education by people like Fidel Castro in the years before 1959?
Well, right from the word go, just in the aftermath of this insurrection that I mentioned, he was tried for his part in attacks on two army barracks. And in his first defense speech at that trial, which became known as History Will Absolve Me, he started to talk about his political program. And in that, he made a very clear indication that education would form a part of that. A couple of years later, when himself and Raul Castro and others were exiled in Mexico and began really planning the insurrection, they started to think more clearly about what that might mean. And the insurgent movement, which now was known as the 26th of July movement, put out a manifesto in which they articulated a desire for the extension of culture to the furthest corner of the island, preceded by reforms in education. So education and culture were very closely linked very early on within the revolutionary program.
What's your sense of the degree to which culture was emphasized and honored in Cuba pre-1959? In general, as a whole?
Well, I think the nation of Cuba didn't really have much say. It wasn't a very democratic society. As I've said, the culture was confined to this elite minority. It was very monetary orientated, very commercial. So entrepreneurs would be commissioning artwork. There wasn't really a sort of public sector, as we would understand it, in terms of state support for the arts. So there was a lot of disconnection between the artists, the people, and those who had access to culture.
Tell us about the cultural society called Nuestro Tiempo that was founded in 1951.
Well, this very much came out of the sense of disconnection between artists and the people. Initially, it was a core group of musicians who founded the society, and very quickly, artists and writers started to collect around them. Initially, they were concentrating on their aesthetic practice. Several members of Nuestro Tiempo were members of the Communist Party. And after the attacks on the army barracks in 1953, members of the Communist Party decided that they would step up their activity in the ideological field. And Nuestro Tiempo provided the perfect format for that because artists within the society were already politicizing themselves. They were enacting creative resistance against the dictatorship. And so it made perfect sense for these groups to come together. There were many interconnections already through artists and writers who were members of the party. But the sort of wider cultural machinery around the party started to get more involved with the society and started to try and orientate them a bit more politically.
Did Nuestro Tiempo have to operate underground given the repression of the dictatorship?
To a large extent it did, yes. And to be a party member in those days wasn't something that was actively discussed. Certain members of the society were certainly subject to repression. So there are stories of Batista's underground police coming in and seizing copies of books from members of the society. Permissions to travel were withheld, so artists couldn't move freely in and out of the country. There were various different acts of repression that were enacted against the members of the society, yes.
So when Fidel Castro and his revolutionary comrades, when they took power in Cuba in 1959, did they consider themselves Marxists or communists?
No, the revolution wasn't fought on a Marxist platform. It was a movement of national liberation to regain the national sovereignty from the neo-colonial relationship that existed between the United States and Cuba, which had been preceded by centuries of colonial rule by the Spanish. So Cuba hadn't, in fact, enjoyed its own national sovereignty for quite some time. And that was really the platform on which the revolution was fought. But there were those within the leadership who had an understanding of Marxism, who'd read the key texts of Marxism, And that sort of emphasis began to find its way into the revolutionary milieu in the immediate aftermath of the triumph of the revolution. But having said that, the actual explicit nature of the program wasn't made clear until spring 1961. So that's when the government started to become much more explicit that the program was actually socialist, although those who'd been observing it before were able to see that it was clearly socialist in its orientation. But it was actually a final act of aggression on the part of the United States that drove Cuba into the socialist and Soviet ambit.
And that was the Bay of Pigs.
Indeed, yeah.
So what did Fidel Castro say about the importance and relevance of culture and art to the revolution?
Well, Fidel himself was more interested in sport, but he understood from his comrades that culture was an integral part of the new society that they were trying to build. So when it came to actually dealing with culture, he delegated it to those who knew better than he did in that field. But at the same time, he firmly embraced the idea that culture was central to the society that they were building. He talked about returning art to the people. When we think about the pre-revolutionary era that I've described, which was very elitist, there was a very clear and conscious decision taken to disband that kind of elitist mentality, to break down the barriers between the urban and rural areas, to bring literacy to the people, to bring culture to the people. That formed very clearly a part of their early program.
Give us some details about the literacy campaign that Castro and his comrades instituted soon after they took power.
Well, in the immediate aftermath of the revolution, so as soon as the revolution had triumphed, Che Guevara was actually instrumental in teaching all the comrades who'd fought alongside him to read. And then slowly, slowly, that program was extended. And in 1961, Fidel Castro gave a speech at the United Nations saying that within a year they would eradicate all illiteracy on the island. And the way in which they did that was that they called for volunteers. 250,000 people came forward, around 100,000 of whom were young people, teenagers, many of whom were women. And they went out into the countryside and taught the peasant population to read in a sensational program that means that Cuba has the highest literacy rate in the world today, either the first or second highest in the world today.
And this literacy campaign, I mean, to what extent has it been identified as embodying or symbolizing the kind of energy that the revolution both contained and unleashed?
Well, I think there's a couple of things that are important to mention. One is that young people who had been too young to play a part in the Revolutionary War suddenly had a role within revolutionary society, which was fantastically important in terms of giving them a place within society, making them feel involved, and changing their consciousness. There's a fantastic film that's just came out a while ago by Catherine Murphy. It's called Maestra, which has a double meaning. It refers both to the mountains in which the insurrection was fought, but also means teacher. And she documents the literacy campaign. She has fantastic archival footage, but she also interviews many of the women specifically who took part in the literacy program and asks them about their experiences. And this really conveys the idea that it was an emancipatory thing for them. Many of them were young and they had to try and negotiate permission from their parents to go out, leave home for the first time and get involved in this program. And you can really see many of them trace their empowerment and their time within society to that point of the literacy program. So that was one of the most important things. And on an international level, it was such a high-profile project. The fact that Fidel announced it at the United Nations and the whole world was aware of what they were doing was a very clear signal on the international stage that they wanted to democratize access to everything.
That's the voice of Rebecca Gordon Nesbitt. She joins me on Against the Grain. Rebecca is founder and researcher of the Center for Cultural Change in Kent in the UK, and she's author of To Defend the Revolution is to Defend Culture, the Cultural Policy of the Cuban Revolution. I'm CS, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. A lot of resources, as I understand it, were also devoted to training teachers and setting up schools.
Yes, that's right. So in the immediate aftermath of the literacy campaign, you have this newly literate population, many of whom hadn't had access to education before, and some of whom took up places at schools. But many of the people who were taught to read during the literacy campaign were actually beyond school age. So this refers mainly to the people who had served as brigadistas within the literacy campaign. Many of them entered the school system. Some of them were already at university. Budgets for schools were increased tenfold, and schools were built and renovated all around the island to make sure that there was a system in which people could be educated, right from primary through to university-level education. It's important to mention also that when we think about the relationship between education and culture, many of the people who'd served as brigadistas during the literacy campaign were retrained as arts teachers. Tens of thousands of these arts teachers were trained up and took their skills out into the population, initially in factories and farms and other workplaces. And in the heyday of this program, which became known as the Aficionados program, there was around 1 million amateur artists practicing in a population of around 6 or 7 million. And by the same token, art schools were opened up, fantastic international quality art schools in Havana and throughout the rest of the island.
Yeah, and this training of art teachers by the thousands, this was part of an effort, as you write, to bring art to the people. And so how much of the cultural project of Cuba was about sort of breaking down the barriers between art and artists and people and society?
Yes, just to be a bit pedantic there, the actual ethos was bringing the people to art rather than art to the people. So it wasn't this kind of top-down mechanism by which art was inflicted upon the people. The idea was very much that the people would be encouraged to access art in whichever way possible. So there was a huge network of museums and galleries that was built up and renovated, and people were encouraged to visit exhibitions of art that had been requisitioned from the previous regime, new art that was being produced by people within the country. But then Fidel invoked the transition from spectators to creators, and the idea was that art would be made available not just as a passive spectatorship exercise, but as a very active participatory way of producing creative stuff oneself. And so within the capitalist world, we tend to think of there being this great separation between art and the people. That's almost a deliberate and conscious thing that we can trace through history. But in Cuba, that division has largely been broken down, which is quite incredible. It's really one of the biggest experiments in the world that has succeeded in doing that. Within that, there's still a distinction made between amateur and professional artists. So this huge Aficionados program still continues to this day. Everybody has the right to go and access creative activity after work or after school or whatever, learn to make art, learn to play a musical instrument. And if they have an aptitude for it, they can proceed to the professional ranks. So there is, in theory at least, movement possible between the two realms. At the same time, professional level education is fantastic in Cuba. Many, many fantastic professional artists have come out of Cuba.
So where concretely would one go to participate or enroll in an Aficionados program?
Well, in every municipality in Cuba, there are organizations called Casas de Cultura, houses of culture. And everywhere you go, you see them, and they're a kind of nexus of community activity. And so people would go and join their local casa.
So what did Fidel and Che, what did they think about art's role in creating a public, in producing a public that could enjoy and engage with art?
Well, the schemes that I've mentioned so far were the very practical steps that were taken to engender a new creative public. And the ideas underwriting this were many. One was that art was a form of social production. It was a valuable tool in creating a new society. Fidel rightly said that art has always been instrumentalized in every age, but the difference is the end to which you put that instrumentalization. And the way that they conceived of culture was as a tool of human happiness. The end product of this social production process would be human happiness as a way of releasing people from alienation, increasing their own liberation. And so that's really how culture was conceived. And at the same time, you have an idea that a revolutionary consciousness had been developed among those who'd fought in the insurrection. But that consciousness didn't necessarily extend through the whole population. And so there was an idea that an engagement in culture would help to engender a population that really tried to understand what was going on around them, made them more self-reflexive, more critical, and able to engage in this new society that was being created. And finally, there was an idea that a sort of side effect of all of this was that economic development would be encouraged as well, because Cuba in the 1950s was hugely underdeveloped, and suddenly a new economy needed to be created. in order to sustain the new society. And so putting people's spiritual and cultural development number one would have a side effect that people would be engaged in material development as well. The idea was that if you were more educated, more cultured, you could play a more holistic part within society.
When people think about art under communism or socialism, many of them think about art that is propagandistic, that is didactic, that is instrumental in relation to government ideology. To what extent did that conception of art prevail or make any inroads into the Cuban scene?
Well, it's important to remember that when we talk about the revolutionary government in the aftermath of the insurrection, it's not a monolith. It was made up of various different factions. So you have Fidel's 26th of July movement, you also have the former Communist Party, and you have a whole strain of student activity as well. And these different voices were all brought together under the revolutionary banner, and they all had slightly different ideas about how culture could and should be. And within that, you have various individual personalities as well. So there was a huge kind of discussion about these issues. And in 1961, the revolutionary government set up something called the National Council of Culture. Now, I mentioned that the Communist Party, the pre-revolutionary Communist Party, had been developing ideas around culture and cultural policy. So it seemed natural and logical to give control of culture to the Communist Party, who'd been dealing with these ideas in the 1950s. But within the Communist Party, there were various tendencies, various opinions about how culture should operate. And unfortunately, there were those on the orthodox wing of the party who felt that they should try and implement some of the ideas that Stalin had been implementing in the Soviet Union, who believed that socialist realism was the way to go. They were very hardline. They proposed that there should be the complete eradication of idealism and its replacement with materialism, and they wouldn't tolerate any forms of abstraction, surrealism, and other morally suspect forms of art in their eyes.
And socialist realism was the officially sanctioned style of art in the USSR beginning, I think, in the 1930s, and that really stressed glorified depictions of the communist future and communist values.
Indeed, yes. The kind of idealization of the worker within society. And very early on, very prominent artists and writers who may or may not have been members of the Communist Party were making very articulate arguments why this shouldn't be allowed to happen in Cuba, because they had the benefit of hindsight by then. It was really the 1934 Literary Congress in the Soviet Union that laid down socialist realism as the official trope of the revolution, and the Cubans had time to see how that played out and wanted nothing to do with it. By and large, the majority felt like that. So very influential voices rejected that way of working. Not least Che Guevara, who in 1965 wrote a text called Socialism and Man in Cuba, and he completely rejected the idea of socialist realism as a kind of dead form of art that only functionaries could understand. So the argument was put forward that culture within the revolution should be much more dialectical. There should be a process, a discursive process, in which art forms from around the world should be embraced and critiqued, and the parts were found to be valuable should be accepted and incorporated into what was happening in Cuba. So it was a huge struggle. It was by no means an easy process, but the idea of art as propaganda has largely been resisted. The idea of this didacticism, this need to convey very literally what was happening within society, was rejected. Of course, there are exceptions to that when we think about educational documentaries that were trying to explain what was happening within revolutionary society. But by and large, the tendency towards much more lateral cultural production was encouraged. And we see that there was an embrace by the revolutionary government over time of work that absorbed the values of revolutionary society and communicated them in whichever way their producers felt fit.
I'm CS. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. Rebecca Gordon-Nesbitt joins me in studio. She works with the Center for Cultural Change in Kent in the UK, which is an umbrella organization that enables critical and creative researchers to explore alternatives to the current sociocultural malaise in the capitalist West. And she is author of, and we are talking about this book today, To Defend the Revolution is to Defend Culture, The Cultural Policy of the Cuban Revolution. It's published by PM Press. We have a link to that book on our website, againstthegrain.org. The book grew out of a dissertation that Rebecca wrote at the University of Strathclyde. So, and I know we're sort of jumping around in terms of time here, but you have Castro and his comrades taking over in 1959. And then in October 1960, there is a meeting of leading artists and writers, which resulted in a manifesto that I think was produced a month later. What's important to know about this meeting and the manifesto that resulted?
Well, one of the most important things to note about this is that when we're thinking about early ideas around culture, they were very much coming up from within the artistic community. So the fact that writers and artists called this meeting in the first place to discuss their role within revolutionary society is highly significant because it shows a great commitment to this, the social change that was being enacted around them. And they weren't prepared to allow their fate to be determined by bureaucrats. They wanted to play a very active part in that process. And so in the manifesto, we see that they are aligning themselves very firmly with the revolution. They're supporting the Declaration of Havana, which had just been made. And they're really trying to ponder what their role within that society should be. And out of that meeting came the program for a First National Congress of Writers and Artists, which was held the following August. It had to be postponed because of the Bay of Pigs invasion. It had initially been planned for spring that year. But they dictated their own program. They decided who they would invite to these meetings. And they had an idea that they would want to form an artists' union out of this meeting.
And they did.
And they did.
One really kind of compelling little vignette you present in this book, To Defend the Revolution is to Defend Culture, relates to Alberto Korda. So he was a photographer and a very prominent one that served Castro. What happened to the work and outlook of Korda because of the Cuban Revolution?
Well, somebody's written a book. Lee Lockwood wrote a book called Castro's Cuba, Cuba's Fidel. And in that, he has an interview. He interviews many people within the revolution. And he describes Korda as having been a very happy-go-lucky hedonist before the revolution, who suddenly had this great moment of a sort of eureka moment in the aftermath of the revolution, partly through his work alongside the revolutionaries as a photographer. And he suddenly realized that he had a role within society, which is a common realization to people who were artists during the 1950s. They had this real sense of social inutility during the 50s, and all of a sudden the doors of imagination are thrown open and everybody has a part to play within society. And it's important not to understate the prestige that was conferred upon artists as having this new role within growing society.
It must have been an incredibly heady atmosphere in the years after the revolution.
Absolutely, yes. And there was a very anti-bureaucratic strain running through the revolution as well. So everything was really done on the fly. There were ideas that were put out there that were very democratic and very anti-elitist, anti-imperialist, but nothing really congealed or consolidated during the early years. And so one of the great writers of Cuba, Ambrosio Fornet, has said that the best years were the years when they didn't have any cultural policy.
Yeah, indeed, because this happens, right? After a while, organizations get set up and bureaucratization proceeds, and there's a kind of effort, would you say, to regularize things and systematize things and regulate things.
Yes, well, it's important to mention that the first two and the most important two cultural institutions that I would define in Cuba, the Film Institute and Casa de las Americas, which is a Pan-American cultural house, those institutions were set up within 2 months of the triumph of the revolution. And so they bypassed any of this bureaucratic stuff that might happen afterwards. So there was a great recognition that new institutions needed to be created very quickly, but unencumbered by the great weight of bureaucracy. And what happened was, in 1961, as we've seen, the National Council of Culture was set up, which is where the bureaucratic machine starts to kick in, because you then have an intermediary between the government and the artists.
And so to some degree, was there kind of a conflict, or was there tension between this National Council of Culture, which was controlled by the what used to be the Cuban Communist Party, which was now the Popular Socialist Party, between that, which kind of represented the bureaucracy and the intermediary, and these two organizations you just mentioned, which tended, it sounded like, to be more grassroots and more spontaneous?
Yes, the organizations I've just mentioned, the New Film Institute and Casa de las Americas, they were very open in their approach, what we might describe as progressive, not very bureaucratic, and very heavily infiltrated by artists and writers. So filmmakers, in fact, in the 1950s, developed the cultural policy that would give rise to the Film Institute. Cultural producers were very instrumental in forming Casa de las Americas, and it became a great nexus for people, and still is today, who are visiting the island through the literary prize and through a great art collection that they've amassed. And so that did set them at odds to some extent with the new National Council of Culture, but they were by and large protected from bureaucratic influence, mainly through the revolutionary prestige of the two people who led those two organizations. And so they became, during the dark times of the revolution, which we might talk about, they became a place for people to shelter, really. They provided protection for artists against any bureaucratic tendencies. And outside of those institutions, if we think about a clash directly between cultural producers and the new National Council of Culture, that became very evident very soon after it was formed. So in January 1961, you have the new National Council of Culture being set up. Then you have a film was screened on television in the immediate aftermath of the Bay of Pigs invasion, which was supported by a journal, a literary cultural supplement that was produced every Monday by the main newspaper. And they commissioned a short film that was screened on television. Everybody had the right to see it because televisions were in most homes in Cuba in those days and still are. This film was slightly politically ambiguous. If it hadn't happened in the immediate aftermath of the Bay of Pigs invasion, it probably would have gone without comment and it would have attracted wider cinematic distribution. But as things stood, because it was a very politically sensitive time, the island was under siege from CIA-supported militias, it was felt that cinematic distribution should be denied this film. And the artists and writers who'd supported the film saw this as a spectre of Stalinism being projected over the island, and they predicted the total end of culture and were very horrified by this. And so you can see how the debate became polarized very quickly. Now, of course, within that, there are minutiae. There are personal differences between the various protagonists involved in all of these debates. But to cut a very long story short, the magazine that had sponsored the film on television ceased production in November of that year. And there were attempts made within the wider cultural milieu to kind of quell the discontent that had erupted during that time. So in June, there was a series of three meetings held in the National Library in Havana, attempting to resolve these disputes. And at the final of these three meetings, Fidel gave a speech that retrospectively became known as Words to the Intellectuals. And in that, he tried to articulate a very broad basis for cultural production on the island. And the phrase that's most quoted from this speech is, within the revolution, everything, against the revolution, nothing. Which means that as long as you're producing something that fits within the revolution and isn't explicitly counter-revolutionary, then your work will be accommodated. So it was a very open statement. People have deliberately or otherwise misinterpreted that, but for me it's a very open statement and it set the pattern and the tone for cultural policy over the next decade.
Does the statement mean that if you produced art that had nothing to do with the revolution but was not counter-revolutionary, that that would be okay?
Yes, absolutely. For me, I like to give the analogy or the kind of contradistinction with George W. Bush's phrase, if you're not with us, you're against us. It was the opposite of that. It was, if you're not against us, you're with us. So it was very inclusive.
Rebecca Gordon Nesbitt, we were talking about her book, To Defend the Revolution is to Defend Culture, the Cultural Policy of the Cuban Revolution. We'll take a short break and speak more with Rebecca about her really interesting book. Please stay with us. And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. Rebecca Gordon Nesbitt has worn many hats over the years. She's worked as a curator at the Nordic Institute for Contemporary Art in Helsinki. She's been a researcher in residence at the Center for Contemporary Art, Derry Londonderry, and a research associate at Arts for Health at Manchester Metropolitan University. And she is currently a researcher and staffer at the Center for Cultural Change in Kent. And her new book is To Defend the Revolution is to Defend Culture, the Cultural Policy of the Cuban Revolution, which examines the Cuban revolutionary government's commitment to culture. And the book also, and I'm quoting from it, seeks to isolate the main tenets of Marxist humanist cultural policy as it evolved in Cuba from 1959 onwards. Marxist humanist cultural policy. So, what strands of humanism can be found in Marx's thought and writing?
Well, if we think about it from the Cuban perspective and how they interpreted this, the two main ideas were individual liberation and social transformation. And we've seen what kind of an integral part culture plays in the idea around individual liberation. The idea was that by becoming involved in culture, people would have happier lives. That was really the essence of it. And in doing so, they would play a part in overcoming alienation. If we think about social transformation as the other strand of Marxist humanism, as we find it in Cuban cultural policy, we've seen the role that culture plays in societal development through education, through culture, through playing an active part within society, through developing revolutionary consciousness, and possibly also playing a part in material development.
A lot of people would focus, when they think of Marx, on sort of material economic reality and political economy. And you devote a brief section in your book to really identifying where in Marx you can find references to human happiness and self-actualization and how important it was to Marx that not just the economic, strictly speaking, the economic system be changed, but that people be changed and people be liberated.
Yes, absolutely. And this was very much picked up and run with in Cuba. So there was an idea that obviously it's not a new idea. Lenin advocated it, Gramsci after him, and Che Guevara picked up on this idea of the new Cuban man. Now, that's laden with the kind of gender-specific terminology of the day, but what he meant was the new human subject, and more specifically, perhaps, new human relations, which prioritized involvement in society over material reward, prioritized happiness, prioritized man's liberation and solidarity.
So again, Fidel and his comrades take over in 1959. In 1968, in January 1968, there is a Cultural Congress of Havana. What stands out to you about this pivotal gathering?
One of the main things that stands out, if we think about it in its appropriate historical context, is that Che Guevara had just been assassinated in Bolivia, and his project was very much an attempt to stimulate continental revolution throughout Latin America and beyond. What happens when he's killed is that they lose the major figurehead in the battlefield, but the anti-imperialist ideology then shifts over into the ideological field, with culture being central to that. So at the same time, the United States was very aware that this was going on and tried to quell and disrupt the consensus that was building up in Latin America. Robert Kennedy went on television in 1966 to warn the citizens of the United States that continental revolution was coming, whether they liked it or not. So the US really stepped up its activity in the area, trying to disrupt solidarities that were being built. And at the same time, in articulating a position of continental struggle, Cuba was very firmly distinguishing itself from the Soviet Union, which didn't have this policy. And so when the Cultural Congress of Havana was hosted, anti-imperialism was absolutely center stage, and underdevelopment was one of the other main themes. And so Cuba is very much shining a light on its own situation, looking at itself as a country escaping centuries of underdevelopment and calling upon the world's intellectuals to try and help them in this quest. So around 600 of the world's intellectuals came together in Havana and the onus was put on them to really think about underdevelopment and imperialism and the relationship between the two and the ways in which their work might contribute to dismantling both of those.
And how did the Congress, how did that Congress of 1968, how did that affect the cultural scene on the ground in Cuba?
Well, it put Cuba in a very prominent position on the international stage. And what I find is that when Cuba's enjoying great international prestige, conditions at home flourish. Conversely, when Cuba is closer to the Soviet Union, we find that orthodox voices are emboldened and culture tends to shrink a little bit. At home, some of the ideas that were perpetuated at the Congress became very important. So you see some of the most prominent artists and writers and cultural organizers chairing the different panels that were hosted. There were five different panels within the Cultural Congress, and prominent people took responsibility for each of these and then progressed the ideas that had been discussed by all the intellectuals. So just to take one example, the idea was that looking at cultural imperialism and how that operated, it seemed necessary to both recognize how that happened, but also to develop antibodies, as they described it, against cultural imperialism, which meant being very aware of what was going on and trying to resist and rebuff these advances wherever they were found. So that might mean artists being co-opted by grants or exhibitions or invitations to otherwise participate in things that were happening, for example, in the United States. And artists and writers who had been taking part in that discussion were very attuned to those sorts of ideas and on high alert, and that would carry them through for the next few years. So the ideas that were perpetuated at the Congress really filtered down into Cuban society over the next few years and were expanded upon by the artists and writers.
You referred earlier to the dark years, and I think here you're referring to the years 1971 to 1976, something like that. What happened to Cuban culture and its relationship to this state then?
Well, we can see things starting to darken towards the end of 1968. In August 1968, the Soviet Union invaded Czechoslovakia. And although Fidel was very dismissive of this invasion on Cuban television, he couldn't publicly declare his opposition to it because Cuba was part of the Communist International. And as a result of this failure to explicitly denounce the invasion, Cuba lost a lot of international friends and became rather isolated and was welcomed closer into the Soviet ambit. And as I've said, that tended to embolden orthodox voices. So throughout the late 1960s, you start to see artists being maligned in the press. And everything came to a head in 1971 for a couple of reasons. One is that a poet who was fairly politically ambiguous, having served time in Soviet Union and in Czechoslovakia and developed a rather anti-communist perspective, this poet named Alberto Padilla, he was, in 1968, he was honored, his poetry was honored by the National Union of Writers and Artists by a jury, an international jury, who decided that his book should win a prize and be published. And at that time, the union published a caveat in the beginning of the book to say that they will publish this book, but they didn't feel it was particularly appropriate to a revolutionary society. So there's a distance being put in place there. There were also a series of articles that came out under a pseudonym in the magazine of the Armed Forces, which similarly denounced Padilla for his political ambiguity, and various other artists as well. In 1971, Padilla was imprisoned over the content of a novel that he was writing, which was similarly politically ambiguous, and this prompted a letter to be addressed to Fidel from many intellectuals from outside of Cuba who had previously been supportive of the revolution, including Jean-Paul Sartre and people who had visited the island. And this put the revolution in a difficult position because intellectuals from outside had criticized it without really fully understanding the facts on the ground. And in April 1971, a Congress had been organized called the National Congress of Education, and that was hastily converted into the First National Congress of Education and Culture, providing a platform from which the revolutionary leadership could answer the criticisms that had been leveled at them from outside. Fidel took the opportunity to make a speech that castigated a very small minority of intellectuals who'd criticized the revolution from outside without fully understanding what was happening. And again, this lost international friends seemed to be something of a rift opening up between Cuba and the international intelligentsia. The CIA was very active in the ideological field, set up something called the Congress for Cultural Freedom, which had journals published in many, many different countries and different languages. And they served to exacerbate the rift between Cuba and the international intelligentsia. And what happened in the immediate aftermath of the Congress of April 1971 was that a former army officer who's been suspected of authoring the articles in the Armed Forces magazine was put in control of the National Council of Culture. And he was there from 1971 to the mid-1970s and enacted a huge program of repression, particularly aimed at artists who'd come to maturity before the revolution. And instead, he favoured young artists who were politically naive and tried to almost indoctrinate them into a kind of new way of producing art. And so we see what Ambrosio Fournette has termed the five grey years, spanning from 1971 to 1976. In fact, there are those that argue, probably quite rightly, that the period lasts longer than 5 years, and it was probably much darker than grey, so there are those who like to call it the Black Decade. And during that time, many mistakes were made, and it's now universally acknowledged within Cuba that that is the case, that a wrong turn was taken at that moment. There's been a lot of analysis dedicated to where they went wrong and how they went wrong. And luckily, towards the end of that period, in 1975, the Cuban Communist Party had its first Congress, and it was able to analyse some of the mistakes that were made during that period and put steps in place to cancel out some of those mistakes. And the most obvious step that they took was to dissolve the National Council of Culture and replace it with a Ministry of Culture, which was headed up by Armando Hart, who'd been the first Minister of Education and was a Marxist-humanist philosopher, very closely connected to artists and writers and other people in the kind of progressive bureaucracy.
Rebecca Gordon-Nesbitt joins me in studio. She is founder and researcher at the Center for Cultural Change in the UK, and her new book is To Defend the Revolution is to Defend Culture, the Cultural Policy of the Cuban Revolution, which grew out of research she did for her dissertation. I'm CS, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. So I wish we had more time, but what's your sense today of the extent to which Cubans and the Cuban government place value in art and see a relationship between art and society and people?
I think it's as integral now as it ever was. The three cornerstones of the revolution are education, health, and culture. And we hear a lot about health and education, but maybe not so much about culture. But it's absolutely vital to the society of Cuba. It's encouraged at every turn. Everywhere you go, you'll see a gallery on every street corner. It's incredibly easy to access culture. One area that we haven't talked about today is film, which was the Film Institute is something I mentioned. But so after the Film Institute was set up in March 1959, very, very soon after the triumph of the revolution, the idea was that a new film industry was needed to be born. As I mentioned, filmmakers had come together in the 50s to think about how that might work, and to draw on the indigenous talent that was there and also the subject matter that they found all around them. They were quite influenced by the Italian New Wave and the idea that you would reflect what was going on around you. And so the Film Institute commissioned very many interesting films, initially documentaries, but more lateral and narrative explorations soon started to come out of that. And they were also responsible, and still are, for a network of cinemas around the island. So around 600 cinemas in a small population were built around the island. And for those areas that were more inaccessible, there was a mobile cinema program set up, which would see a young projectionist going around on a truck or being drawn by a donkey, or even in a couple of cases, going around the island by boat to take cinema into the furthest reaches of the island. And even today, it's incredibly easy to get to the cinema. It costs about the same price as an egg. So it really turns on its head the kind of way that we understand the film industry. It took the profit motive out of that and made that very, very accessible. So that's one of the great triumphs of the revolution in terms of culture: the accessibility of film, the accessibility of art, the ability of anybody to get involved in art if that's what they decide to do.
And
How would you compare the Cuban revolutionary approach to culture with culture the way it's handled and treated and viewed in the capitalist West?
Well, certainly where I come from, the main value of culture is articulated in economic terms. It's only now, actually, in the past couple of years, that we've started to look in the research field at the individual and social value of culture, which to me is slightly hilarious, given that Cuba has really understood this for more than 50 years now. They, as I've said, they prioritize the individual and social value of culture and considered the economic value as only a byproduct of that process.
And in recent years, art has really been seen as the key to economic recovery, right? Like in the U.S. and in the U.K. and Richard Florida came out with his book Through Creative Class. What is your sense of that emphasis and that possibly renewed interest in art and creativity?
Well, I take issue with that, really. I'm not sure that it's very helpful as a construct or indeed very relevant or easy to prove that there's a connection between culture and regeneration. Florida proposes the idea of the creative city, the idea that there's a creative class that migrates to a particular city, makes it more vibrant and makes bank headquarters want to relocate there or whatever. I'm not sure how this really plays out in real terms. So we do see culture often implicated in the whole idea of regeneration. But actually, if you look at it closely, we're sitting here not a million miles from places in San Francisco where there's a sort of class cleansing going on, where people who are artists and don't have much money, don't make much money, aren't necessarily supported by the state to make their art, are being eradicated from the city because of this regeneration process. So although artists might be at the first wave of regeneration and are often implicated in that, in beautifying cities or in colonizing new places, what you often find is that once that first wave is over and the developers start to move in, artists are systematically eradicated from those areas. So I really don't hold much faith in Florida's analysis.
You write that many artists and cultural commentators in the West have, in response to state defunding of the arts, advocated a return to the autonomous status of art. Tell us about that and what you think the consequences of that have been or might be.
Yes, well, in the capitalist world, as I've said, there's been a historic divide between art and the people. And if artists reassert their autonomy, what they're effectively saying is that they are relinquishing their social role and widening that gulf between themselves and the people. And so for me, this is part of the root of the problem. The fact that we've lost sight of the social value of art means that we have no arguments to present when our governments ask us what the value of art is and why they should fund it. And it drives art into the hands of the market.
So what do you think the opening up of Cuba to improved relations with the U.S., what do you think that might do to cultural policy as articulated by Raúl Castro and his government?
There are many facets to that question. One is that there is a lot of enthusiasm being directed, at least seemingly in the political sphere, towards Cuba at the moment. In the discussions that I've been to around this subject, people tend to agree that it's a change of tactic rather than a change of policy. So the embargo is still in place. There doesn't seem much movement really around that. So when it comes to money coming into the country, that is through remittances generally from people who have family abroad. And that can create huge disparities within a society like Cuba, because only people who have family abroad have access to that foreign currency. In terms of cultural policy, money can also play a fairly deleterious role. And so what we see is artists have freedom to travel and have freedom to make money from their work. Somehow cultural products are able to maneuver past the blockade. And again, we see inequalities being introduced into society that way. But what I will say is that Cuba's very wise, and their entire process can be defined as a process of trial and error. And so if they see that something is happening as a result of a policy in one area of society, they can very easily rectify that and make compensations or allowances or adjustments, which means that society is rebalanced. And so I have faith in the Cuban people and in the Cuban government to act sensibly and steadily. They've been waiting for this for a very long time. Obviously, the blockade should be lifted, but it doesn't mean that the floodgates of capitalism are going to be opened.
Rebecca Gordon-Nesbitt, we have links on againsttothegrain.org to her new book, To Defend the Revolution is to Defend Culture, the Cultural Policy of the Cuban Revolution. as well as to the Center for Cultural Change, where she is a staffer and researcher. Rebecca, congratulations on the book, and thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
And this is CS, suggesting the important thing is not to stop questioning, and we hope you'll join us next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. You can visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio, resources and links, and a way to sign up for our podcast. And check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio.
Wisconsin Nature Notes from the Nature Conservancy. What is singing, blooming, creeping, and crawling in the Badger State? It's January, our coldest month of the year, and while ice is thick on most inland lakes, that's not always the case on the Great Lakes. The amount of ice and the length of time the ice is present varies from year to year. And in case you've forgotten, the last two winters were particularly icy. Last March, Lake Superior was 84% ice covered, and Lake Michigan, 79%. Two winters ago, ice coverage on the entire Great Lakes peaked at about 93%, ranking as the second most ice coverage in recorded history. The winter of 1979 holds the record, with about 95% ice coverage. To show how variable this can be, in 2013, only about 38% of the lakes froze over, while in 2012, just 13% did. 2002 holds the record for the least ice coverage, when only 9.5% of the lake surfaces froze. All of these statistics matter because they generate a host of complex impacts with many winners and losers. For instance, the duration of ice on the lakes can be detrimental to the shipping industry and lead to delays in the spring shipping season. But heavy ice cover can reduce the amount of evaporation from the Great Lakes in the winter, contributing to higher water levels, which is good news for shippers, increasing their capacity to transport cargo. Higher lake levels are also a benefit to those who spend millions to dredge boat slips, channels, and harbors when lake levels are low. Relative to the Great Lakes fisheries, in the shallow waters where whitefish spawn in early winter, ice cover protects whitefish eggs from destructive wind and wave action, so more ice is good for them. The amount of snow on top of the ice also matters. Ice cover with little or no snow cover allows light penetration, which promotes algae growth. And although too much algae is a bad thing at the base of the food web, algae is absolutely necessary, supporting living organisms in the lakes, including valuable fish species. With at least $1 billion flowing into the Great Lakes commercial and sport fishing industry each year, ice cover can be a significant factor affecting the region's economy. Stable ice over a long winter also protects wetlands and shoreline from erosion. On the other hand, huge ice jams can form in rivers connecting the Great Lakes. These jams constrict the flow of water from one lake to another, causing flooding upstream, less water for hydropower plants downstream, and a surge of ice that can damage shoreline properties. Winter ice cover on the Great Lakes has declined on average by 71% over the last 40 years, while summer water temperatures and annual evaporation are on the rise. All of these are important factors controlling water level fluctuations and the overall health of the Great Lakes ecosystem. So, while you're sitting by your wood stove dreaming about warm waters this summer, keep an eye on the lake ice this winter. While it appears immutable, it's like slow cooking. There's a lot of action taking place. Learn how you can take part in conservation in Wisconsin. Go to the Nature Conservancy's website at nature.org/Wisconsin. Wisconsin Nature Notes is the work of the Nature Conservancy in Wisconsin and Mind's Eye Audio in Madison.